Buenos tardes. This is Caipacha with the weekly Pele report for May 19th of 2015. I'm down here in Tepoztlan near Cuernavaca, Mexico. And this is a very beautiful place. I'm going to see if I can get you a shot of the temple that's in the background. I just climbed up 5,000 steps to get up here. So, yeah, so this is astrology for the soul. It's a little bit of what's going on out there in the great cosmos, reflecting what's going on down here. And I'm going to show you at the end of the report, I'm going to post it's an hourglass going on. It's very exciting. This week particularly, not only on Thursday, the sun goes into Gemini, but then on Friday, it comes into an exact opposition with Saturn. 1 degree of Gemini to 1 degree of Sagittarius, Saturn over there in Sagittarius. And then, at the same time on Thursday, Venus comes into an exact opposition with Pluto at 15 degrees of Cancer to Pluto is up there still at 15 degrees of Capricorn. And these are then, of course, the Sun over there is 45 degrees from Venus, and Saturn is 45 degrees from Pluto. And they are, Venus is 135 a sesquiquadrate, away from Saturn, and the Sun is a sesquiquadrate away from Pluto, and it makes this amazing hourglass, these two oppositions, Very significant, but let's just talk about the Moon a little bit, Right now, the Moon is in Gemini. On Wednesday, she moves over into Cancer. On Friday, switches down and over into Leo for a wonderful weekend. Moon moving through Leo. This weekend is going to be awesome. Until on Monday, she moves and switches over into Virgo. There's the temple through the trees. I don't know. I'm going to see if I can find a better shot of that. So what's going on? It's kind of interesting, right? The sun is in Gemini. Mercury just went retrograde, on Monday. It's in down there in Gemini. Venus in Cancer. Moon moving through Gemini, Cancer, Leo. Everything is, all the personal planets, Sun, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, are over here in the personal sector or part of the zodiac. Opposite Saturn and Pluto, up there in Sagittarius and Capricorn. Which is your professional, objective, transpersonal, out there world. So we have these oppositions going on, and that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. And I just want to give you one final shot of this beautiful. There is Tepoztlan down below, but there are some beautiful mountains around here. All right, so let me find a spot, talk at you, get into the astrology a little bit. Yeah. Okay, well, I hope this works. this is a Pele report with a little Mexican music drifting up the mountain from the city way down below. The sound really carries around here. I hope that you can hear my voice along with the music and just follow along a little bit, So what's going on these days? Kind of interesting. Polarization. We're infinite spiritual multidimensional beings that come in to visit this planet Earth. And we come down from the spirit world and our soul comes into an ego. And that ego lives in separation and learns and evolves through polarization. I am different than you. There's me and you. There's masculine and feminine, light and dark. And we take one side or the other. And in astrology, this is oppositions. Yeah, and it's really about, let's look at these oppositions that are going on this week. You know, really powerful oppositions. And, you know, if we look back 6 months, it would be like back in December when Venus was conjunct Pluto, Sun was back conjunct Saturn, and now 6 months later, both of these guys are opposing. So it's kind of interesting. You can look at the seeds that were sown. And what seeds were sown? And what is this dilemma or polarization about? Like I said, it has to do with the personal versus the professional. Yeah? You know, this Gemini, Cancer, these is the puer eternis, the puella eternis. I want to travel. I want to study. I want to learn. Variety is the spice of life. Let's go to another country. Let's take another course. Learn a different language. Get a new partner. You know, fool around, goof around, enjoy. Feel my feelings. Go to the beat of my own drummer. Change like the moon changes. The moon, you know, rules Cancer. Venus is in Cancer. And then we've got opposite that. Yeah. Pluto in Capricorn, and the boss is not going to give me a vacation, you know, and the government wants all my tax money, so I don't have any money to go on any trips anywhere. And, you know, and then Saturn, you know, is over there in Sagittarius. That's religion, limiting belief systems, like, you know what, you don't deserve it. You don't have enough money, you know, you're being punished, or you should be ashamed of yourself for not being dependable and committed and doing your duty and managing all of your responsibilities. And it's just like, so, you know, we can be experiencing a little bit of this war internally. You know, we can internalize this and just go, well, you know, gosh, should I stay or should I go? Should I please myself and expand my inner world, or do what I'm told and follow the leader and, you know, follow the guru or the teachings or whatever, and try to be what everybody else wants me to be? But more often than that, what we tend to do is we tend to jump on one side of an opposition and project the other side of that opposition onto somebody else. So in this case, I will be Gemini in Cancer. Okay, I will be youthful and fun and maybe a little irresponsible and changeable and mutable and flow and, you know, have all this fun, good time. And then I'm going to experience, right, the police or the government or the banks or the parents or the employer or the corporations, or, you know, run into problems with authority. And when it comes to, like, Venus opposite Pluto, we may in some way project our authority onto our partner. Our intimate partner, our sexual partner, our romantic, yeah, lover partner, and have them, you know, play Pluto for us, yeah? Like, try to kill us, try to gut us, try to bring us down, you know? And so we can really get caught, you know? If we stay in this opposition, if we polarize ourselves, we either can tear ourselves apart during this time, or we can project and get into arguments and hassles. Gemini is brothers and sisters. Okay, Sagittarius is teachers. Capricorn is bosses. Cancer is mom and family. So, you know, we've got all, there's all, it's all represented here in this hourglass, you know. And we had last week Mars opposite Saturn. So that probably kicked the ball off. But the other thing that is good about an opposition is it's like a full moon. What happens at the full moon? Illumination. It's the fulfillment of the, you know, it's like the seed blossoming from that particular seed that was sown, like I said, back in December. And the blossom, the flower, the positive output of this is self-discovery. It's all about self-discovery. It's all about becoming more conscious of our unconscious. Cancer is our personal unconscious. This Venus opposite Pluto. Pluto is our root chakra, underworld energy. So, you know, this moon sweeping through Cancer and then up into Leo over the weekend, she's going to come out into the fire, onto the stage, conjoin with Jupiter, you know, Saturday and Sunday is like really going to be awesome. And then she moves into Virgo. But I would say this is a time of like going deep down in under and tapping into. Maybe it's some memories from childhood or past lives or, you know, grade school teachers. Who knows, man? But we tend to hold on to conditioning, to these childhood patterns. And astrology says that we're infinite souls that reincarnate and we chose our parents. So we chose our childhood conditioning and we chose our childhood experiences. For better or for worse, light or dark, pleasant or unpleasant, in order to become aware and learn. So we've all gone through, and it's time in some way, I would say, to graduate from the school of childhood. Like we've gone through childhood to learn certain things so that we can teach and heal and, you know, illuminate humanity and heal other people and be the wounded healers. Yeah. So we want to bridge this separation, and it's and the way out of polarization, the way out of battle and fighting and arguing is to move towards that opposition, towards the polarity point. Pluto polarity point is Cancer. Venus polarity point is Capricorn. We want to move, we want to bridge these oppositions. And some of the oppositions, let's look at the Saturn Sun, Sagittarius Gemini, is left brain, right brain. Intuition and imagination says one thing. Linear, logical, rational thinking says another. And so, like, you know, these can go back and forth. But what we want to do is we want to bridge, yeah? We want to bridge the left and the right brain. Cancer's the baby. Capricorn is the elder, yeah? So we've got, you know, this youthful, personal, individual, you know, tantrum. I don't care what anybody says. I'm going to follow my feelings. And then we've got the Capricorn. I'm going to do my duty and do my responsibility and suppress and deny all of my feelings and emotions in order to show up and be a good person for my community. You know, there's a middle ground between these also. So bridging, yes. You know, this is a time of bridging oppositions, and instead of arguing, fighting, polarizing, it's just time to move towards that opposition, and that creates the third point, the Trinity, yeah? So the two polarities ascend, yes, to a higher point of consciousness, and that's what it's all about, yeah. So the mantra for this week, if I can make it up on the spot here, come on, boom, to bridge the separation, there is no application. I must use my imagination and develop intuition. Gemini. We've got retrograde Mercury. We've got the Sun. We've got Mars in Gemini. It's gadgets, iPhones, iPads. It's like, you know, engage that left brain and, you know, get into this right and wrong and logical and, you know, rational and, you know, argumentative and, you know, like really, you know, bust out all of the, you know, oh, this is right and you're wrong and I got this and I got that and I got the proof and I've got the information. And I'm all like, it's in your head. There's a lot of energy going on now with stationary Mercury going retrograde, where the tendency can be to think too much and to keep our eye. It's like close your eyes, do some Kundalini yoga, do some meditation, stop the visual stimulation that kills the imagination and stimulates that thinking all the time. And get out of your head and into your feelings. You got the moon moving through Cancer. coming around to Venus in Cancer. Get into this place, yeah, of self-love and feel those feelings and feel that inner child and feel those emotions. And those emotions lead you to spirit, to the intuition, to Gaia, to the mother. And that heals the separation. The Saturn in Sagittarius is going for natural law. So it's possible. It's possible to please ourselves and the other simultaneously. And part of our responsibility, Saturn, Pluto in Capricorn, you know, it's our responsibility to be in touch with ourselves and to be honest with ourselves and to be truthful with ourselves so that we can fully give of ourselves. So take some time off. Take a break. Yeah? The tendency with Western civilization is to place far too much emphasis on external appearances, superficial material signs of success, to the neglect of the inner feeling world where true love is found. Just to be a little profound. Mantra once more. I'll get out of here. Let's see what it is again. To bridge the separation, there is no application. Put down your freaking phone. Get off of Facebook for a fucking minute. Jesus. Come on. Get out of the city, into the country, out to the mountains, into the nature. Feel your feelings. Feel the love. Where was I? To bridge the separation, there is no application. I must use my imagination and develop my intuition. Namaste. Aloha. So much love.
Okay, before we go away from this page, I just want to read what he said. Again, to bridge the separation, there is no application. I must use imagination and develop intuition. You would think by now I would stop cutting my head off. Ha ha. Must be opening that crown chakra too much. Anyway, the meaning of the report this week remains the same. We can pit ourselves against external authorities in any shape or form. There's a smorgasbord out there, everybody. Or we can move to a higher dimensional frequency to realize they are externalized parts of ourselves. Mwah. Mirroring back some important information about the nature of what it means to be human. Living on planet Earth. Now, as that doesn't make sense to you, I simply don't know that I can explain it any more clearly. There are many means available for us to personally experience these higher dimensional frequencies, ranging from natural means like orgasm, meditation, extreme sports, plant medicine, to less natural like alcohol, whether that is higher or lower is questionable, I know. Chemicals or other forms of physical, emotional, or mental abuse. Altered states not always equaling higher states, for sure.
Right.
Yet Pluto opposite Venus wants to take us down into the cellar of our consciousness to discover the deeper meaning of our life experience that Saturn in Sag is wanting to teach us. We can resist the call to research and open to the wholeness, as in both light and dark, or totally of who and what we are. Yet in the long run, we'll only be cheating ourselves and the world as true power of self-determination, energy, chi, or kundalini, rises from the deep, dark root of our being. Let's just face it. Suppression leads to a shorter life, and self-delusion, as you fool yourself into thinking you are someone you are not. Enjoy. That's the end. Okay, everybody. So we've got our Bistic Mama, right? Yeah. We've got to make a little adjustment here. While we're contemplating this one, we played George Mitchell being interviewed with Tom Hartman. George Mitchell was the envoy to Iran in 2009. And Rama got to talk to him on the phone with, I think, Mr. X or something like that. Or it might have been, I can't remember, it might have been. But Rama can't remember exactly what he was talking to him about at the time, but it was a big deal. In other words, he knows all about Nisara, just so that you know that this fellow is going to go to the top, Rama.
This is from Jamie Sams. Bear medicine.
But that's Mystic Mama, right? Okay. Yeah. Enter the silence and know. And this is bear medicine from Jamie.
Jamie Sams.
Jamie Sams, who wrote the medicine cards. Okay. Let me move my stuff out of the way. Okay. The strength of bear medicine is the power of introspection. It lies in the West on the great medicine wheel of life. Bear seeks honey, or the sweetness of truth within the hollow of an old tree. Gets his nose stung sometimes. Bear enters the womb cave to hibernate, to digest the year's experience. It is said that our goals reside in the West also. To accomplish the goals and the dreams that we carry, the art of introspection is necessary. To become like bear and enter the safety of the womb cave, we must attune ourselves to the energies of the Eternal Mother and receive nourishment from the placenta of the Great Void. The Great Void is the place where all solutions and answers live in harmony with the questions that fill our realities. As we choose to believe that there are many questions to life, we must also believe that the answers to these questions reside within us. Each and every being has the capacity to quiet the mind, to enter the silence, and to know. Many tribes have called this space of inner knowing the Dream Lodge, where the death of the illusion of physical reality overlays the expansiveness of eternity. It is in the Dream Lodge that our ancestors sit in the council and advise us regarding alternative pathways that lead to our goals. This is the power of bear. The female receptive energy that for centuries has allowed visionaries, mystics, and shamans to prophesy is contained in this very special bear energy. In India, the cave symbolizes the cave of Brahman. Brahman's cave is considered to be the pineal gland that sits in the center of the four lobes of the brain. To hibernate, bear travels to the cave. I just wanted to remind everybody that Brahma's consort is Lakshmi, And I mean, that's abundance time. The giver of all that is about prosperity and opulence, everything. So to hibernate, Bear travels to the cave, which is the center of the four lobes where the pineal gland resides. In the cave, Bear seeks answers while dreaming or hibernating. Bear is then reborn in the spring, like the opening of spring flowers. For eons, all seekers of the dream time and of visions have walked the path of silence, calming the inner chatter, the internal chatter, reaching the place of rites of passage, the channel or pineal gland. From the cave of Bear, we find the pathway to the dream lodge and the other levels of imagination or pure consciousness. And that's all there is. So do we have this other one too, Rama, the little five-minute bleep? Rama, what's that called again?
Oracle
report. Yes, then I can read Patty Kolbarovos. She prolifically manifested another article, ladies and jelly beans. Okay, we'll just turn it on.
Hi, everyone. This is Laura Walker.
No, that's too long.
Okay. It's just what it is.
We got a long one there. Well, we got a few minutes. Let's go ahead and try. We'll play some of it, and we can play the rest of it later. I think she might have a reason for doing that.
From May 20th.
Well, today is the 23rd. That's not too far back.
From OracleReport.com. Welcome to this recording. I'm very happy to be doing something today that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and that is share one of the wise owls with the rest of the Parliament. How this came about was the process of many, many months, and now the time has come to talk about something that's been really helpful for me to usher in the second renaissance and adjust into the fifth dimension. And this is a question that I've been getting a lot of emails about. How do we do this? How can we participate more? What does the fifth dimensional consciousness mean and the second renaissance mean? Well, I think after we talk with my guest today that you'll have a nice little answer to add to all of the answers that come with that. So with that, let me read you the brief bio to introduce my guest today, Carolyn Barnes. Carolyn Barnes graduated from the American Institute of Alternative Medicine in 2002 and holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy with a minor in music from Wittenberg University. While studying for a year at the Brussels Conservatory of Music in Belgium, Carolyn was exposed to a more natural approach to medicine. That experience inspired her years later, during a midlife career change, to go back to school and become a therapeutic massage therapist. Her current practice specializes in the John Barnes approach to myofascial release. Carolyn's passion is empowering people through self-care techniques. Carolyn currently lives in Dublin, Ohio, with her husband, Kevin, their children, Matt and Amelia, and their golden retriever, Nana. Welcome, Carolyn. Hi, Laura. Hi, everybody. I'm so happy to be talking with you today, to be introducing everyone to your new book.
Oh, thank you, Laura. I'm just excited to speak with you. We've been planning this for a long time.
We really have, and it's such a happy day to be doing that. I was very honored that Carolyn asked me to write the foreword to her book, and I thought that that might be a nice way to open up our conversation because it's a brief foreword, a brief introduction, but it didn't start out that way because when Carolyn asked me to do it, I started writing a lengthy treatise on trauma and all, how that affects the body and how it's stored in the brain. And then I was at a deadline and I had to turn it in and I was like, this isn't going to do at all. I don't like this. It doesn't feel like the book at all. So I changed it, and I wrote strictly from my heart. And so this is my foreword to Carolyn Barnes's book, Return to Ease. This book, Return to Ease, began healing long before it was published. In this way, it could be considered magical. After spending just a few minutes with it, you may come to agree. Many things make this book magical. Its author is a healer of shamanic caliber with a deep love of nature, beauty, and unity. The combination produces a powerful facilitation of happiness, magic. Its title is also a mantra that immediately transforms one's mindset and body state. Thinking it or stating it out loud instantly realigns us with our calm center, the place of true power, magic. Its wisdom quickly becomes evident because it creates a strong desire to come back. Our bodies begin to crave the practice, magic. Its mission gives us what we need in order to do what we need to do. A rare path to self-empowerment opens equally to all. Everyone at every level benefits. Magic. Spirit comes from many working in concert. Something inside everyone who was involved in the project was inspired. A harmony of individual thoughts, ideas, and visions coalesced around the recognition of something special. Magic. What you have in your hands holds its own type of magic for you, but the effects it will have on your life are very real. Prepare to be enchanted. And that's how I feel about the book, because as I watched Carolyn write it and produce it with all of the people involved, the photographers, because this is like no ordinary book, let me tell you, everyone was affected, and I watched the process, and that's what it was. It was a magical process, and that's what I wanted to write about in the foreword. So, Carolyn, you're an author now.
Yes, but can I talk for a minute about that process you went through? That's
Please.
Amazing, because the blessing from your foreword came from you trusting your heart, trusting what you were feeling. And that's the message of my book, Laura.
It very much is. It pervades. And I truly mean that I believe it is magical. It is a magical work of art that does the most magical thing of all, which is self-empower. And so in the most unique, beautiful way, because this is a book that is many, many things in one. I always envisioned that it would be a coffee table type of book, and it absolutely has turned out like that. But before we talk a little bit about the book, or a lot about the book, maybe we could talk for a little bit, Carolyn, about what is myofascial release and what is the fascia? What is all this we're talking about?
Well, the book is divided into two sections. The first part of the book is some inner work, and the second half of the book is some more active work of releasing what would be called restrictions in the fascia. And the fascia is this amazing tissue in the body. It's another word for it is connective tissue, and it literally connects your feet to your head and everything in between, Laura. It looks like a three-dimensional spider web type tissue. And it wraps around all the organs, the bones, the muscles. Each individual cell is wrapped in fascia. And just, you know, for a minute, think we have over a trillion cells in our body. The blood vessels, the nerves run through fascia, and they themselves are covered in fascia. And so this amazing material is made up of collagen and elastin fibers, so it's very strong, and it has this ground matrix substance that's more gelatinous in nature. So when there's a restriction in the connective tissue, it can have a tensile strength of up to 2,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. So that can actually pull bones out of alignment. It can impede the functioning of organs. It can be like an elephant sitting on a nerve. So the fascia just is this just amazing tissue in the body.
Yes, the way that I even feel it to be is the spiritual connection, the body's spiritual interface.
Yes, there's some people who feel that the nerves cannot carry information as fast as people think it does, and that most of the processing in our body actually happens through the fascia, and that the fascia contains light energy as well.
Yes, and so when we have traumas and deep emotional experiences and stresses, everyday even stresses, the fascia responds, right?
If the trauma is not released, it will stay stuck energetically in the fascia, and not necessarily in the same place that you would think of as impact or where the fascia was directly affected by the trauma, but it can travel through the system as well.
And I've had personal experience with this because back, about 2 days after the Aquarius new moon, my back went out. And, you know, longtime readers know that I have had issues with my back before. And this was really, really bad. And this was the time that Andrew and I just announced Oracle Academy. Well, I couldn't walk. And I couldn't walk for 3 days. And Carolyn is like, Laura, I think maybe you should try my fascia release. And so I was ready for anything at that point. And so, Carolyn, tell everyone how you suggested that I go about doing that to find a therapist.
Yeah, I have studied under John Barnes, and John Barnes's approach to myofascial release is different from some other approaches that are out there. So John trains all of us as therapists to really tune into the person who comes to us for a session and to view ourselves more as facilitators, that true healing comes from within the body, and it doesn't happen from a person outside of yourself. It happens inside you. And so a therapist is simply a facilitator to help you return to wholeness. So John's approach is very gentle, respectful, and so he has this amazing website where you can look up a therapist based on where you are geographically. It's called www.myofascialrelease.com, and you can find a therapist that the profiles also tell what level of training a therapist has and usually has their website. So it's a great resource for, there's even therapists in Puerto Rico and Australia, all over the world. So,
and most of the MFT or myofascial therapists are massage therapists or physical therapists, right?
Right, or OTs, occupational therapists as well. And I know in one class I took, there was even a doctor. Chiropractors are taking more of his classes as well as nurses. So it's starting to gain a wider appeal and more mainstream recognition of the work.
Yes, it's very second renaissance-ish. If I could, you know, just make up a word there, because it's about a unified field, isn't it? It's truly holistic.
It is. And it's about returning the person to wholeness, too. It's very self-empowering work as well.
And I can really corroborate that, because I did exactly what my pal Carolyn said, and I went to John Barnes' website, and I found the therapists that were trained in my area, and I talked to them, and I chose my lovely myofascial therapist, Tara, who's a goddess. And when I went in, I couldn't walk. A friend of mine had to actually drive me to the session. And when I left, not only was I taller, I mean, my friend had to look up at me, I was actually taller, and not only could I walk, we went shopping. And so I know that's a very, and this is somebody who was bent over. I mean, it was horrible, horrible pain. And so I know that's a really dramatic kind of experience with it, but that's how my body responded. And then I didn't stop because, and it's an ongoing thing, but that is one element of this. And what Carolyn has done as part of the Second Renaissance and her mission is to add on something quite, I would say a very nice addition to what MSR offers. And that's her book, Return to Ease. So, Carolyn, tell everybody just a little bit, you know, an overview of the book. You started with, like, how it is set up. But, you know, it's different than most books for techniques and, you know, how to perform self-care.
Right. The subtitle of the book is Gently Reconnect with Your Body's Natural Mobility and Joy. So reconnecting to what we do naturally again is just a remembering, a renaissance, like you said. We just need to remember. So the first half of the book is the inner work. It's some grounding techniques, centering, a gratitude practice. There's a body scan meditation. And then the second half of the book is more active, using a little small therapeutic ball, a foam roller, and some movement. But the book is about connecting again to your body in ways that are easy and comfortable and less, and releasing some of that trauma. And we do that through our feeling, sensing side of our brain, the right hemisphere. So to help you stay in that space of the right hemisphere, I tried to take every detail I could think of to make the book as beautiful as possible, to keep you in that feeling, sensing space where miracles and healing happen. So throughout the book, there are carefully chosen nature photographs where that's the only thing on the page is this beautiful picture of something from our natural world. And then it was carefully matched on the left side of the page with a quote to inspire you on your journey of healing and returning to wholeness. So there may be images of foam rolling, but then as you're turning the page, you'll also come across images of nature and inspirational quotes as well. It's really pretty.
Oh, yes, indeed. It is beautiful. It is special, and it's so Second Renaissance and fifth dimensional because it is such a combination of all of those elements, all of those healing elements, the quotes, some of, you know, just words are powerful. And when I had written in the foreword that Return to Ease, the title of the book, is a mantra, well, some of my friends and I have been kind of using that for a few months now. And if you find yourself, you know, just stressed out or whatever, if you repeat the mantra, return to ease, you do return to ease. It's just like it automatically kicks in. And so just saying that, if you've been working and doing just some of the nice little stretching poses with the book that are lovely and they're laid out, I mean, professional photography and lighting, and I mean, it's truly just gorgeous and just contributes to the overall feel. But all of it, it's a whole healing. It isn't just the movements, it's the pictures and it's the words and, of course, all of the love that was behind it, because this has been a labor of love for Carolyn and everyone who's been lucky enough to be involved, because we all feel that way. There's been a lot of people to bring it to life, Carolyn's vision, and I'm ecstatic. I'm just over the moon about how it's turned out, but not just that, what it does for people, because I saw it happening just for people getting involved in the book. They would start a healing. Something would happen inside of them in their own personal world, and they hadn't even done any of the poses or, you know, stretches, movements. But then when you do, when you get the soft foam roller or the pinky ball, if you ever, you know, decide to go that route that's shown in the book, you get pretty attached to those things. And, you know, this would be a good time to talk about the rumble roller and how that's different and kind of how the rumble roller played a part in this, right, Carolyn?
Yeah, it was when I first started tuning into the Oracle Report many years ago. And Laura, you mentioned something about doing self-care with this foam roller that had nubs in it called the rumble roller. And being a massage therapist, it's a very physical job. And I was finding that I needed to find some ways to work out some discomfort I was feeling. And I thought, well, if Laura liked it, there must be something to it. So I ordered it and thought, wow, this is great. I'm feeling looser. And as I started to experiment on myself, I started to share it with my clients. And then I saw amazing things started to happen when we all started to do self-care. There was a luminosity that started to come back to people. Sparks would return to people's eyes that had been missing before. And I saw joy start to come in. So I got really curious about what was happening, what was triggering this. And I saw when people start to connect again to their bodies in ways that are comfortable and pleasurable, they feel safe and they start to release some of these restrictions that hold fear. And it kept them from being all that they could be. It kept them from experiencing joy and just seeing the marvelousness in life.
Yeah.
And amazing things started to happen that the more they did self-care, now we're just talking 5 minutes a day here, and it's that easy, but a dedication of that 5 minutes a day, every day, they became more patient with themselves and started to have compassion with their own body, their own selves, and then they started to notice that their family members were saying, wow, you know, you're more patient, you're more kind, and people had awareness of becoming more compassionate. So there was a direct correlation I found between physical restrictions in the fascia or the connective tissue, restricting ease of movement, and that manifesting in their lives as restriction in relationships or their experience of life. So as they started to create more ease in their physical bodies doing these simple techniques and self-care, then miraculous things started to happen around them, Laura.
Can you tell us about that?
I just saw people start to undertake activities where once they had thought they couldn't do it or they didn't have the skills, that they suddenly felt they were capable, or people felt they were happier in life and enjoying life, and they started expanding in different ways. It was just amazing.
Yes, what it does is begin to ripple across your life, because as the restriction eases, your power comes back. And that's not just power, you know, in one certain area. Again, it's the whole body process. And so more power returns to your life as a whole. And it just...
Okay. We're going to stop right there because of the time. That was a good introduction into... An activity that inspires one to bring more courage and confidence in their hearts. That was good. Okay, so everybody, it's time to go to our conference call. And the number is area code 209-647-1600. And the PIN code is 205-353-8663. And so, again, it's 209-647-1600. And this participant code is 353-863. Okay. Pound. Yes. Okay. We'll see you there. And at the top of the next hour, we'll be back at PBS Radio, the best radio in the universe. Aloha for now, everyone. We're going to go right back to Hugh Lynn. I just want to say, let's encircle this case with the six policemen and with our brother, Freddie Gray. You know, he's on the other side, and just talk to the inner child there. And he represents all the inner children of all the inner city kids that ever end up with that challenge. You know, our seven generations on to now, let us walk that good red road for the sake of our children. So here we go again. This is the title of this YouTube is called He Healed the Criminally Insane in 4 years. Okay, here we go. Some more.
I'm not here to act as God to say, well, if I clean, I can save you. Don't do that.
Can you tell us more specifically what you did within yourself when that woman with cancer showed up?
Yeah.
What did you clean within yourself?
Yeah, so I said, as I was hugging her, I said to the divine, thank you for giving me this opportunity for this lady to come up. So that I can look at myself, what's going on in me that I would like to make amends for. And so I said to the divinity, I'm sorry for whatever's going on in me. And there are specific cleaning tools I use that are unique to me. But basically I'm asking the divinity, I'm sorry, please forgive me for whatever's going on in me that this woman should show up in my life. Experiencing her saying to me, I've been diagnosed. Now, one of the things I had to work on, because I just had to work on this whole judgment about somebody saying that somebody's going to die in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
I had to work on that one.
Yeah.
And again, people can't help. If a doctor says, you only got 3 months to live, he can't help it. That's the data in him. Mm-hmm. So now the question is, who's going to start deleting the data? But it's so easy. Yeah.
Can we delete all the data?
I'm sorry?
Can we delete all the data?
That's a divinity's job, not mine. My job is to appeal. Divinity's job is to erase, so I can't say the divinity. Like, occasionally I say, come on, hurry up.
did Buddha delete all the data as far as you can tell?
You'll have to talk to Buddha.
So, when you think of enlightened masters on the planet, you don't necessarily think of them with data deleted then, or do you?
No. I'm more interested, like in somebody else, I'm not interested whether Shakespeare is a risen master. I'm more interested in some insights that I could use to get some of these ideas across. For example, Shakespeare's, I think, the notion that poor soul, these rebel powers that be array. So Shakespeare's already said, hello, the sin, the error is in the soul. So I go, oh, yeah, that's sure. It's not out there someplace. It's a rebel power, what Shakespeare called, for bemoan, grievances for gone. It's played before, it's going to play again. The tragedy is, we don't know that. That's the tragedy. We don't know that the data runs us. That's the tragedy. And so we're going to repeat it over.
Yes.
Over and over.
Have you reached a point in your own evolution where you can see where the data runs you and where you are clear?
Sometimes, but rarely. I'm more interested in keeping the cleaning going nonstop. I don't go that route. I'm absolutely clear in my soul that the divinity has given me one more chance to make amends for whatever is going on in me. So I'm clear that my only purpose for existence is to free myself so I can be free and once more be in line with the light and be in a light.
Do you have an experience at times? Why are you laughing? Do you have an experience at times of feeling like you're in the groove, like you're in perfect alignment? Like are there moments where...
I never look for that. But there are times in which I experience like absolute love for my friend here. That I can experience. I have children, grandchildren, of which I do the cleaning because I want to make sure that I'm not attached to them in any way so that they can get the information directly from the divinity, not from me. So I'm just cut all the time. And occasionally, when I get a call from my children, I have two daughters, 30 plus, I should feel love for them.
Yeah. When you say cut, are you talking about cutting out the cords?
Yeah, I'm talking about erasing memories in me that I experience them as quotes, judging them, how come they don't do this way, they don't do that, and all that. Yeah. And they're beautiful, my children are. Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. But my responsibility for them is to set them free from any grasp that I have on them, which is memory, like trying to grab them.
Would that include loving memories?
A memory is a memory.
So
it's a dead memory. There's no such thing as a good memory.
So to set them free from memories would be not to remember any of the past that you've ever had together?
Or to at some point, to see them as gods.
Now you say, or.
Yeah.
They're mutually exclusive.
Oh, of course. Because if I have, and you know, I'm going to be cleaning with them to the day I die. It's just the way it is. I mean, they're there, I experience them, and I want to make sure I'm just cutting these ties so that they get the information directly from the divinity, not from me. Mm-hmm. So, am I sure? I'm never sure. I don't know that well. I just keep cleaning.
You speak, or maybe it's Joe that references the experience of wonder and the importance of the experience of wonder. Could you talk a little more about that?
I'm more interested in the experience of freedom.
More than one.
Yeah. It's interesting because that question brings up, there was a chap, they called himself chap,
yes,
in Australia, who I gave a lecture, and he kept saying, now, wait a minute, you mean you don't want us to be curious? That's his comeback. I said, well, to be at zero, you can be in awe. But if you want to take curiosity instead of awe, be my guest. It's hard to put things down only because I'm never certain if I'm inspired or not. And,
yeah.
To be very honest, I don't care. I'm just doing the cleaning, just nonstop. So I don't have any intentions to... For example, people will call me. I used to do these things. I don't do anymore. There's a young man in Hawaii who he's having a very difficult quote. His mother is saying he's having a difficult time. People don't like him. He's not doing well at school. And so I'm reading the email. I'm doing the cleaning. What's going on in me? This is showing up. And she asked how to help him, and I had to remind her, you're not helping him. It's only about you. What's going on in you that you're experiencing that way?
And do you take individual clients?
I used to, maybe 20 years ago, but I don't do that anymore. Yeah. Better that they should learn how to do it on their own, huh? Put us out of business. So we can be vacationing here in Monterey instead of trading around the world.
I'm curious what in you is creating your commitment to such a rigorous teaching schedule?
Somebody asked me that, but they asked me in a different way. This is the way they asked me. They asked me, "How did you come? How did you come around to doing this?" And I said, "I don't know. life is a mystery, and I just happen to be here in this moment. And there are all the forces, and I have no idea how these forces brought me here. But I'm clear. I'm clear that I'm here to clean with you. You chair the board." This guy, the camera, that thing is going to get on the internet, going to get on shows, and the shows are all generated by oil. You know that, right? You have a cell phone?
Yes.
You know what the source, the power of that cell phone is? Oil. Without the oil, that you guys wouldn't have any. Couldn't generate a cell phone message. We're going to look back. So I'm cleaning with that. The rape with Mother Earth.
I know.
We're raping Mother Earth. But we can't help it. So I have to remind myself, nobody can help it. Everybody's stuck in programs. And so somebody's got to get to the cleaning, and I'm willing to do it. Marvin's willing to do it. More and more people around the world are willing to do it.
You have, I guess the answer I was looking to that last question is, I had in mind the possibility that you had the hope that many people would be doing this work and that we might change
If nobody showed up, I would do it anyway.
But would it not be your hope? Or maybe you don't hope that there would be
Don't you think it's a form of manipulation?
I've thought that.
Well, I can erase that then. I can work on that. I want to get to zero, so that the people who are divinely correct to come will come.
Right.
That's mine. I'm not here to promote anything. I'm not intending to do it. I'm not conscious I'm doing it. I may be, but I think it's a disservice to people to promote something and then have them come when for them divinely it's not correct to be wherever they end up being, you know.
In other words, promotion speaks to their memories.
Yeah.
And stimulates their memories.
Yeah.
But can promotion also speak to them and stir them to want to erase their memories?
If I clean, let's say I clean, and there are 8 billion people out there. If I clean and I get myself back to zero, even for an instant, everybody will get back to zero, then it's the divine in them that will choose to do it or not to do it. Not some promotion on my part, or some manipulation on my part. Yeah.
And the book that Joe wrote about you or with you,
yeah.
is that a manipulation? Is that, how do you see the book?
Well, it depends on what page you're on.
Well,
but I cleaned before, and so like with you, he had asked me months and months and months if I would do a book with him, and I did the cleaning. I heard no, just like with you guys, and at some point I heard yes, so I did. Now, I'm responsible for every point in every letter in the book, so there are people who will ask me certain things, and having not read all of the book myself. So. But my own sense, he's a nice guy. And so he shows up for me to clean, and I clean, and I heard, do it. And so sometimes somebody will ask me, like you asked me, well, what does Joe Vitale think about it? I said, you'll have to talk to Buddha or Duvetta. I can't speak with him.
if we have a subconscious, then that's where memories are stored. And some people say it's the physical body that is the subconscious. What about a chair? What about what we would maybe call an inanimate object that does not have a subconscious? Yeah. Where does it store its memory?
It does have it. This thing is alive. This thing is telling me who sat here, all the people who sat here. This thing is telling me where the material came from. It's talking, and as it's talking, I'm just doing the cleaning. So this chair, like you, has the three selves. It has the superconscious, conscious, and subconscious. So it isn't, there's no such thing as an inanimate object. For example, you can talk to the camera. You can say to the camera, how many cameras do you have, Alex? So you can say to the camera, well, we're gonna tape this guy, Hugh Len, so can you, what do you think about that? You can talk to the camera. The camera will tell you. I don't know about that. And then let's say he knew how to do the cleaning and said, well, let's do the cleaning. And so he does the cleaning and maybe the camera will change his mind.
So when photographers say the camera loves you, they're speaking more than they know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. To show you how goofy this thing can be, I had a friend of mine who married a guy who wasn't doing very well in the construction business, and then went like $40,000 he made, and then maybe 3 years later after she married him, he made $3 million. But she knew that her job was to work on all of the projects, talk to all of the projects. And so one day he was having trouble, I think, putting up a scaffold or something. And so she did the cleaning, and she heard the nails. She heard the nails and said, we just can't get along. Can't get along. So if you can't get nails to even get along, then you can't put up a scaffold, you know. The scaffold won't work. So the idea is you have to be able to talk to everything. Get them ready, like little children. You have to say, okay, here we're starting a new project. Here's the address. Here, and then you begin the cleaning right away. And then the right subcontractors will show up. I mean, and the right banking will show up. The right whatever. But everything is alive. Mm-hmm. And so everything has the three selves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've seen the kind of process happen that you're describing where everything just drops into alignment with a plan. But how is it, would you encourage everyone to learn to have the facility that you have of talking to furniture and talking to a plan and talking to all the forces that go into making something work?
Whoever shows up over the weekend and at this lecture, I'm going to
talk about that.
Yeah, but I'm not going to get yelled at the rest of the world. I said, come on, I have something I'm going to tell you about. You could really use. That's an imposition. It's an imposition.
It's not a gift.
It's an imposition. My job is to do my cleaning, and then if I do my cleaning and get back to zero, everybody will get back to zero. That's the only purpose I'm here. And then people show up because they would like to, however they've heard it, and they would like to know more, I'm willing to do that. Because if I can get more people to clean, then I'm going to have more enlightenment, huh?
Great.
as opposed to my light bulb going, my children said, Dad, your light's out. I said, thank you.
Are there certain activities that you engage in life that help you to get to zero more than others?
Yeah, like eating clean foods, drinking liquids that are cleaning, having plants in your environment that clean, of course.
When you are doing cleaning, are you going into an altered state of consciousness?
No.
You're just doing it from your conscious mind and trusting that.
Well, I'm hoping I'm doing it consciously, but I'm hoping I've
talk to my subconscious, who is a computer bank, that the subconscious has heard me enough. I fall in love with it, and has asked it, please help me with the cleaning. And so I downloaded every information that I know about the cleaning, and so my subconscious knows it, and it will do the cleaning.
So, are there any guides or angels that help one with cleaning?
If you eat blueberries, for example, blueberries erase memories and open up angelic kingdoms.
Could you speak to us a little about angelic kingdoms?
What would you like to know?
Are there levels to them? Do they interact with humans?
I don't know those things. I don't go that route. All I know is one day I was cleaning years ago, and then he said, why don't you try a blueberry? Okay. And I said, well, what do you see? I said, well, I can see the angelic kingdom. And then that was it. The discussion ended. I didn't hear whether they were levels, and they stretched down. I didn't hear anything.
Do you mean like nature spirits when you speak of angels?
I don't know what that is.
People say that there are little people that are guardians of plants and the earth.
No, I'm talking about angelic kingdom. Other universes, other dimensions that open up, stretch open. You eat one blueberry, just stretches, and your mind goes, wow. Yeah, and you may not be conscious of it. That's the 11 million for which you're not conscious.
Right.
And it's different with blackberries than blueberries.
I don't know about blackberries. I know blueberries. I know strawberries. Those things. Strawberries, for example, deal with women's hatred for men. Lots there, you know.
That's right. I remember that. I forgot all about that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about women's hatred for men?
Well, I'm going to go back to a story, and the story is probably, they have similar stories across culture. So anyway, this is a Los Angeles story. So Divinity said, hello, heaven on earth, now. I see you get this experience. Adam goes, yeah. Eve goes, yeah, wow, incredible. And so Divinity then says, now you see that tree over there? That's the tree of knowledge. I wouldn't eat that stuff. You see that apple? I wouldn't eat it because you don't need it. You're already perfect. Well, maybe zillions of lifetime, Eve says to Adam, come on, we got to eat that because I think he's keeping a secret from us. And then along comes the so-called serpent part of the, yeah. So finally, they eat it. And then God comes along in his long robe and he came swishing. And then he goes, there's a difference in vibration in this. And Adam says what? What does Adam say? Adam says, she made me do it. She made me do it. And that's the story of women. Abused, neglected.
Scapegoated.
But she made me do it. And so women end up, for example, with menopause, rage. That's rage. That's the kind of stuff that can be prevented. But that's rage.
Menopause is rage?
Yep. Thought I just throw that in, yeah, for good measure. Rage.
Prevented by cleaning?
Oh, yeah, it could be worked on. But you know, it's better to work on it before than wait till towards the end, all of a sudden it's like,
you mean the cessation of menses is rage? Or the symptom of it?
It's rage. This
You're talking about hot flashes and stuff,
yeah,
like that.
It's rage.
Yes.
Yeah, rage. It isn't, quote, natural. It's not a natural state. I can't imagine God would create somebody and create you and say, I'm going to make you suffer. I can't imagine that. So where did it come from? Well, came from she made me do it.
So we have a lot of Ho'oponopono.
You got more than a lot. Yeah.
So that's women's rage towards men. What about men's rage towards women?
Well, but see now you're moving in a way. The question I would ask if I were a woman, what's going on in me that I can clean this thing up? As opposed to looking outside and say, why did you do that to me? And you should get...
Yeah, actually, one of the questions that crosses my mind is, why is it that we have that degree of rage towards each other, fellow human beings?
But you're speaking data. You're engaged. You're wrapping this up as opposed to you can let it go. I love you. Thank you. Whatever you can. I love you. But we have an addiction. The addiction is so intense. We grab things. How come? Have you ever read Chekhov, the Russian short story? That's the theme in all of his stories. How come? Why? Why did they cut down that forest? Why are they doing that? Why is it that we can't get along? Why is it that we suffer when if we were friends, everybody would profit from that? Well, the why is it's old data playing, and we're stuck in it. And if you grab it like the Greeks do, we're gonna analyze it. Like I was trained when I got a PhD at University of Iowa, you're gonna grab it and try to make sense of it. You can't. Billion for which you are clueless. And so the idea is Jesus, Moses, all these great sages that come along to hello, let go.
So have you set aside your analytical processes?
No, you see, I'm still here. What are you talking about? If I had let that all go, I wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be here either.
If you were going to ask you a really rich question, what question would you ask yourself?
Who am I?
How would you answer it?
I am infinitely zero. I'm an exact copy of the source. The infinite. I'm an exact copy. That means I'm perfect in every way. My problem is not me. My problem is the data in me.
Are you an individuated perfection?
What does that mean?
Do we have any individuated aspects?
One more time.
Did God create us individually?
Yeah, of course. So God created you, and your rhythm is very different from ours. Your rhythm is different from the chair. Of course.
And so even at zero limits, I still have a rhythm that is unique.
Absolutely. And you have a rhythm for which then you have a certain purpose for which only you can fulfill. And if you don't fulfill it, then we're all stuck. Yeah. But each of us, like Marvin and me, this chair, we have been given the gift of this lifetime to take ourselves back. What Shakespeare said, to thine own self be true. And who are we? We are like an exact likeness of the divine, which is we're zero infinite. That's what, we're nothing. My mother used to say that to me when I used to go surfing and come home late. You're nothing, you're nothing. But now I realize I
have nothing.
I mean, she was well sigwith about that. You're nothing. Finally, what? I'm 70, and I'm fine. I went, wow, my mother had that insight. It took me 70 years to get it.
Is this? I know that this is a revised version of Ho'oponopono that you work with, and I'm wondering whether or not the method that existed, and I have a small familiarity with the previous version of Ho'oponopono.
Tell me what the previous version is.
My understanding of it is that a group of people would get together if there were misunderstandings among them, and there would be a person standing in as a facilitator, and it would depend upon that.
More like a guard.
Okay. Ensure that a smooth process unfolded so that people would come to some kind of understanding.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In some workshops that I've taken that have been about HUNA and...
There's no such thing as HUNA.
Oh, there isn't?
No. That's a makeup by some white-legged person.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was wondering if in the previous version, the earlier version of Ho'oponopono, before Hawaii was infiltrated by foreigners.
Visited by
foreigners.
Yeah.
If you think that perhaps things were different then, if a society evolved that was perhaps more enlightened.
Listen, if you look at across the culture, across all the cultures that we have in this great village called mankind, you will find only two models, and one model is very rare. And that model is, you got to go talk to a guru to get to talk to the divinity, right?
Right.
This one you can talk directly. You don't need a guru, you don't need a coach, you don't need a master, you don't need any of those. You don't even need, if I'm angry with him, I don't need him because the anger is in me.
Right.
So why would I? So the thing I liked about this when I heard about it 20-something years ago was, wow. It's just my own stuff, and I can go directly to any who can erase it, you know? Yeah. So the Ho'oponopono that we teach, you're on your own, but you got a good coach called God. Yeah. You can talk directly, and only that force in you can erase. There's no guru, there's no master, no pope, there's nobody can erase. Only the divinity in you can do that. So I'm going to talk to why should I go to an in-between? A wholesaler.
You have a whole team of people, do you not, to do the Ho'oponopono work with you?
I'm part of a group of people who we have developed over the last 25 or 26 years. Some of them are coordinators, like my friend Marvin here, who does most of the work. He has to listen to all these telephone calls, get the emails, and I'm glad I don't have to. That's not my part. I wasn't created for that, thank God. And then we have also coordinators who can teach. Who some coordinate teach, and then we have people who teach who don't coordinate, and then we have key people who are key people because of the cleaning that they have been assigned to do, not because of anything else, but they are important people in terms of cleaning. If we can get them involved in the cleaning, we will have an easier job. Yeah, so we have 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So these people are particularly skilled at cleaning?
Not that they're skilled. They're the worst people on the planet. Really? The meeting says, okay, let's get the worst people on the planet to do the cleaning. Wow, I think that's wonderful. Don't you think so? So we have the biggest troublemakers in the cosmos helping the clean. Yeah.
That's cool.
I'm serious. Yeah. So why, you know, Divinity said, Jesus came and said, why would I fall in love, be in love with somebody that already loves me? I'm going to go look for somebody who hates me. So we got a lot of people who are kind of that category who can clean, because that's what they're coming to do. Wow. Yeah.
That's inspiring.
You suppose she got that?
No. I didn't.
Can you share that with us?
Did you get it?
Yeah, go ahead, share that with
me. I don't understand.
That there are people who so want to clean up themselves and they have so much work to do that their cleaning really transforms the planet because how much they have to clean.
Yeah. Yeah. And without their cleaning, it would take a longer time.
They are big vacuum cleaners.
Yeah. Mandungas. And they only showed up over the last 30 years. But Marvin is not one of those. He's one of those finite. He has that.
I can see that.
He has one of those French...
he swivels, really.
Yeah, he swivels. But he's very good at the swiveling.
Yes.
That's how he showed up.
Mm-hmm.
So, Marvin, we haven't let you get a word in edgewise here. Would you like to share a little bit about your experience in doing Ho'oponopono?
Well, I don't know where to start, but it's something that I'm just very thankful for the divinity to give me as a tool to get back to where I'm supposed to be, to be with God. I'm just in awe to have this kind of tool to be able to go back to Him. Basically, it just transforms my life, you know. So, used to be I would, for anything that happens, I would look at other people, other than myself, to point a finger to and say, you know, you did it, instead of looking at me. So, just change the whole thing. So, it's just cleaning. It's just about cleaning. So, that's all I can say.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And boy, they're cleaning to do.
Absolutely. You know, no matter what you do, there's always that.
You know, you have people who are signing up, who want to know this or that. I'm glad Marvin got that area covered.
So you get to just show up and do the work.
Well, but I get to do my part, which is not easy.
Yeah.
Because what you're dealing with is the addiction for engagement.
The addiction for engagement,
yeah.
Did you say?
Yes. Yeah. Like you want to wrap your hands around it.
Yeah.
You want to get a hold of it.
Yeah.
And the realization is people cannot help it.
Right.
So somebody's got to get to the cleaning. And so the idea is that my responsibility is responsibility. So one of the things that we say to the staff in the class, hello, do your cleaning. Don't be asking any questions at the engagement. But they're willing to do the cleaning. The class usually goes fairly smoothly. So... because you know, they can catch areas for which I'm not even conscious of. You know, they can pick it up in there. And how many people we have this weekend, staff?
We have 4.
Yeah.
Including me, 5.
Yeah.
And then my kids are volunteers.
Yeah. Well, it's the cleaning that's going to get us through this weekend, because if we're doing our cleaning, then they will get the information directly from the source as opposed to getting it from us.
Lao Tzu once said that to become knowledgeable is to acquire information constantly, but to become wise is to let go of information constantly.
Yeah.
That would be similar to
So, but more importantly, if you're at zero, you allow everybody else to be at zero, and they get their own information, as opposed to you're thinking you're going to deliver the information. If you're coming from, I got the information, I'm going to deliver it to you, you're going to be in trouble. It's going to be a long weekend. Because if I'm willing to clean along with the 5 other people, they will get, the room will get what it needs, the chairs will get what it needs. I mean, really, it's so profound. The floor, the building, like the Sheraton will get it, the land will get it, San Jose will get it. This will go out now, light up the whole world.
Yes. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tough to do.
There was a point in Zero Limits where you mentioned, where it is mentioned.
I like that. Yes.
That when you were doing cleaning, sometimes you would feel pain in your body.
Yeah.
And I've been working with. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you for.
Yeah.
With a fair bit of dedication, not as much as you probably, but for about 8 months now.
Yeah.
And I noticed times where I would feel, it felt like I would describe it as an energy knot that would congeal and harden and intensify in my body.
Yeah.
And as I kept on doing cleaning,
that
it would sort of dissipate. Is this a common pattern that you...
I think it's different for everybody. That's the thing I love about the Ho'oponopono. Is that there's no one program for everybody. Everybody is their own program. And so the program is to really erase the data, to get everybody back to zero. And once they get back to zero, they'll be awed by who they are. They'll fall in love with themselves. they'll be grateful. But like the word aloha for the Hawaiians, some Hawaiians, I should be careful. Some Hawaiians, when you say aloha, you're actually saying alo means to be in the presence and ha means God. So when people say aloha, you're actually saying I'm in the presence of God. So the Ho'oponopono is to be in the presence of God, and you have to recognize that everything is really God made. And if you mess around with them, it's going to come back and swat you. Yeah. Best to say, ah. Yeah.
Do you meditate, Dr. Gulen?
I meditate with my eyes open.
That's just like Master Dang. Master Dang does that, everybody.
I do meditate, yeah. And there are times when you sort of get into a spaciousness sort of state of being where it feels very peaceful and open and connected. And I'm just curious if that is a state of being that would be similar to what you're describing.
Maybe unique to you. Maybe unique to other people. Other people will get it differently. We will be teaching a meditation process in this weekend's class. But the meditation is about cleaning. So let's say we take it through and you sit there and people, there was one lady in Australia would say, but what do you focus on? I said, you don't focus on anything. But you got to focus on something. I said, well, be my guest. But basically, you do the meditation, so whatever comes up will get cleaned up. As long as you're in that meditation, you can bring it to an end. But as long as you're in that meditation, it's a cleaning process. You're sitting there and all kinds of stuff will come up. It's going to get cleaned up. As opposed to sitting there and going, oh my God, do I have to put up with that thought form? But not the Ho'oponopono. Everything is about cleaning. Including the meditation. That's why I love doing it. I do it zillions of times a day, just for that. Yeah. But I only do it for cleaning. I really want to get back to my original state, which is purity of heart. Yeah. But I think the most important question is, who am I? If you have no idea about that, you'll always suffer. You can't get home. You can't get home. I mean, that's the most important question in creation. Who am I? Yeah. So the Ho'oponopono is about saying, oh, this is who you are. You're perfect already. The garbage that you're experiencing is not you. Just data. They go, huh? And then they go, wow, thank God. How about guilt, Dr. Hewlett? Data. Yeah. What about... I was doing a class with Joe Vitale, and something phenomenal happened. Something that I was moved by. So towards the end, a man in the back of the room says, how do you, I think, not quite if I'm doing it correctly, accurately, how do you clean with my, if I have the experience of having sexually molested my granddaughter? I went, wow, there it is. That's the truth, like nobody's business. So I had a chance to clean with that. And he did it kind of like up it came. And I thought it was beautiful. Yeah.
What are some of the most wonderful experiences that you've had over these 30 years?
Probably realizing more and more that this lifetime is really a gift. And it's a gift for cleaning. It's a gift of going home. It's taken me years to kind of realize that this lifetime is truly a gift from the divine. And it's a gift of to make amends. And I'm willing to do it. I've met some interesting people over the years, but I would say that probably for me is realizing that this lifetime is really a gift, and another gift is the cleaning process. Another gift is identity. and then realizing that we are carbon copies of this pure, perfect source. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have experience of moments or blocks of time where you feel yourself as source?
As what?
As divinity. That being in a state of consciousness, perhaps where you would be merged with your high self, your conscious mind and your high self would open up a window of perception.
I have moments of feeling love for myself. I have moments of feeling love for my children. I mean, the kind of love where you have no attachments. That I have this experience of experiencing God's love for my children. I've had that experience. I've had the kind of experience of God's love for me.
Is it possible that God is the only thing that loves?
Oh, that absolutely so. So God is love. Everything else is a mimic.
I've heard it said that love is looking with the eyes of God and seeing God.
Yeah, but that's what Jesus said. Seek ye first the God. Blessed are the pure in heart. Zero, for they shall see God, but the God in them is seeing God.
Yes.
And I've had those experiences. They've come and gone. Mostly I feel like caught up in data and so, which I need to clean. When you travel the world, you're always apt to have a lot of garbage come up. Yeah. Like one of the garbage I deal with and I work, I'd clean with it before I show up, and I've been cleaning with it for almost three decades, is this notion that you can come to an appreciation of God by grasping, by through the grasping process, the engagement process. It can't be done. It can't be done.
It's a surrender.
Yeah, not that. For me, it's a letting go. It's taking 100% responsibility to just let go. And it's not easy to let go, because the letting go, for example, some people will say, well, I'm clean, but I don't get any result. Well, as they're talking to me, I'm cleaning. What would we be cleaning with? Intention. So I'm cleaning with intention. The person is cleaning with a certain intention. Okay, I'm cleaning with, when people tell me that, I'm cleaning with God is not a concierge. You don't say to God, I'm going to clean it, I want this color, this, but I want it to look like this, and there you go. You look young. So I get to work on that, because I didn't realize I had it. And so people will show up in my life if I don't get really stuck in, what the hell are they talking about, as opposed to, oh, what's going on in me that coming up that I can work on? That's the tough one. Yeah.
Does anyone help you clean?
What does that mean?
Do you have someone that either sets an environmental space?
I think what there's someone. Actually, there are two or three people that I work with that we do cleaning when things come up. You know, if there are things that, for example, if a request comes from, like, I got a request from Singapore. And Singapore, there's a banker there that wants us to come. And so I do the cleaning, and then I give that information to two or three people, and they can do it. And so we can get the information, because we're the baddest guys on the earth. I mean, clean it up, and then to see whether it's correct or not. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Not at all. I enjoyed it. I'm grateful. Got a chance to clean up.
Okay.
I've heard the questions before.
I'm sure you have.
That's the end. That was lovely, everyone. At the very end, it says, why not try this? It costs nothing.
Again. Oh, wait, no, I'm wrong. Obviously, these sort of deals aren't on offer for Joe Pint of Lager. No, no, no. Of course not. It was J.P. Morgan, UBS, Citibank, Barclays, and the taxpayer-owned Royal Bank of Scotland that got such a ridiculous sweetheart deal. Yes, they'll pay a fine of $5.7 billion for rigging the $5 trillion per day Forex markets of the, must have been like $500 billion at least they stole. But as the case will now not go to trial, we have no way of knowing how much money they actually stole.
Well, Max, you mentioned $500 billion, but the truth is we have no way of knowing. And this is the problem with all of these behind-the-door settlements that we see over and over for the LIBOR rigging, for the gold fix rigging, for the ISDAfix rigging. They constantly meet behind closed doors, the PERP and the Department of Justice. They decide what they'll pay. The public, who has been defrauded, has never any way of discovery, of knowing how much restitution they are actually owed. It could be actually $2 billion, and maybe the government's shaking them down, in which case we need to know about that. But it could be, $2 trillion. We don't know.
Well, we have a pretty good idea, because over the past 7 years, the UK economy has shrunk by any meaningful measure. And yet the Bank of England and the government has doubled their debt from £800 billion to £1.5 trillion. So we can reasonably assume that the money that was stolen in the Forex market and the LIBOR rigging scandal, the mis-selling scandal, et cetera, is a subset of that $800 billion. So even 10% of that would be $80 billion that they stole. And I think that's a fair guess in terms of how much they stole. They're paying in the fines, a few million pounds. I think that in the billions and billions of pounds is pretty getting closer to the amount that was stolen.
So whatever the amount is, let's look at what the mindset was of the people involved in these sort of scams. So we have a tweet from Reuters Jamie, and he's looking at the transcripts that were actually revealed about what these how they were rigging the markets. And this is from a Barclays FX trader. He said, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. And the Barclays guy said it in a chat room transcript from November 2010. So, you know, here you have, clearly there was intent that they were defrauding the markets. But if you compare it to the Hatton Garden jewelry thieves, and they broke into a secure, you know, safe deposit facility in London over the Easter holiday, in case you hadn't been aware of this, and they stole an estimated £220 million worth of goods. Again, just like the Forex market, we don't know for sure how much they stole, because a lot of it was, you know, people's cash. There was no like record of what was actually in these safe deposit boxes. But they'll go on trial for blasting that huge hole in the cement wall to get into these safe deposit boxes, stole money from people. And it's no different what this guy from Barclays was doing when he says, you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. He was blasting a hole into somebody's trade, and on paper, it might look less because it was like maybe a few pennies or a few pounds or a few dollars or a few euros he stole. But across trillions of trades, $5 trillion a day, that's a lot of money.
Well, there's two problems. I mean, you make a good point that this is not going to trial, so there will be no discovery. And we will not discover the exact amount of money that these banks stole. And they, of course, enjoy that privilege of not having to disclose the actual size of the crime. But the second problem is that banks tend to classify stealing in turn as market making or providing liquidity. Mm-hmm. So to use this logic, using the Hatton jewelry heists, they should be allowed to walk free because they were, quote, making a market in jewelry. They were making a market in crime and in cash. So at the end of the analysis here, you end up with obviously a two-tier justice system. Not only do you not pay any meaningful penalties for stealing, but you get to define what the word stealing means. So now if this were applied to the rioters a couple of years ago who set fire to a building, they could say, well, we were making a market in flames, and the definition of arson is being changed to mean community building.
And in case you think it's actually a very onerous fine, this $5.7 billion between the five banks, and most people, the ordinary person out there, will say, you know, we've punished these bankers enough. Remember, the new conservative government, their first day in office, the headlines read, "Stop banker bashing." So everybody thinks like they've paid enough. Well, look at this tweet from Citi AM, Barclays and RBS share prices are rising on the back of the Forex fine.
Well, what's interesting in the U.S. is that they have a similar subsidization of the banking industry, but they also give away a lot of food stamps. So the people in America are participating in the funny money, funny printing. Matter of fact, J.P. Morgan prints up the food stamps. They also are a recipient of the subsidies from the government. But here in this country, in the U.K., it's very interesting because the banks are getting subsidies to the tunes of hundreds of billions of free money. They're allowed to commit fraud with impunity. But in this country, unlike any other country, they're also imposing austerity on the poor. So that wealth and income gap is skyrocketing. And I posit this is not an economic policy. This is a social cleansing policy.
Yeah, well, also, of course, banks here, because they're paying so many fines, because they're only lending for property and the property bubble. We see this next headline because, you know, what's happening in the world is people are sick of banks. Satoshi Nakamoto, in his white paper on releasing Bitcoin, noted that the banker bailouts, in particular in the UK, we want our own alternative finance systems, our own alternative funding systems like crowdfunding. And look at this headline from Wall Street Journal. Europe has yet to produce a single internet company valued at more than $10 billion. Of course, there's no seed capital, as we've talked before, like in Silicon Valley, where there are, by the way, very high taxes in Silicon Valley if you're living there. The U.S. has a lot higher taxes than what the U.K. does for these sort of billionaire class.
Right. Well, I created a startup called Start Coin and Start Join. And we're working with a crowdfunding platform, Bank to the Future. We talked about it on the show 3.5 weeks ago. We were launching a crowdfunding campaign, and we're already close to getting to our $1 million.
And why? Because you're going the crowdfunding platform way. And I'm going to turn to a headline about this crowdfunding in the United Kingdom, because, of course, there are no funds there. The banks, the Barclays, the RBS, they're paying so many fines for all their fraud in their banking system. And remember, many people say, you know, Bitcoin won't go mainstream unless you involve the banks, because then it's respectable. Despite all the headlines.
That's heresy.
Yeah.
But your point, there's no money for startups because these banks are paying fines.
Yes, they're paying fines, and they don't want schmucks to compete with them. And we see that in this final headline here. BrewDog snubs the establishment with £25 million fundraising project. Independent craft beer maker's shares sale deliberately bypasses the city, which it blames for bastardization of beer. So it's a Scottish company, BrewDog, and their craft beer maker. Now, they funding, which they didn't use the likes of CrowdCube, which is the only, the equity crowdfunding platform here that is endorsed by Boris and the Treasury, which, by the way, the Treasury now has Jim O'Neill, another Goldman Sachs guy. The Bank of England has Goldman Sachs former head, Mark Carney. But here they're saying the reason why they're going directly to the people, BrewDog, is James Watt, BrewDog's co-founder, said, quote, "We are not the Rockefellers. We are Guy Fawkes. This is about changing small business finance forever. By making profit king, the financial institutions of the city give rise to the bastardization and commoditization of beer. We are burning the established system down to the ground and forging a new future for business from the flames."
Right. BrewDog, essentially, they're a Scottish company. They essentially invented equity crowdfunding here in the world and also in the UK in 2009. Then 2 years later, other competitors came aboard with platforms. You mentioned CrowdCube. There are actually a few that have FCA stamp of approval, unlike BrewDog, which does not have the FCA stamp of approval. But what happens in this country is that you have the emergence of an entrenched oligopoly or duopoly. There's really two primary players in equity crowdfunding here. And the relationship with the FCA is highly suspect, I would say. They're using it as a barrier to entry as opposed to fostering entrepreneurialism. So once again, the UK government and the regulatory committees are involved in stifling innovation and not promoting innovation. BrewDog should not be harassed and written slam pieces about it. They should be celebrated as introducing and inventing a concept, not as the glide path to have some friend of a friend who's down there in Westminster, wink, wink, nod, nod, create a crony capitalist cartel.
Yeah, they were founded in 2007, and since then, they now employ 360 people. And there are a lot of naysayers. I see a headline that says BrewDog deserves consumer backlash. So they've raised £5 million of the £25 million they're seeking, but in a platform called Equity for Punks. And there are people like Emanuela Vartamel, who is CEO of All Street, a city firm that specializes in monitoring crowdfunding schemes, said it was difficult to see how investors will make a financial return on the deal.
To cast aspersions toward BrewDog is foolish. It's actually a listed company here in the UK with a much higher price-earnings ratio, et cetera. They were questioning the valuation of BrewDog. This is their fourth equity crowdfunding, which is they're going for $25 million at roughly a £280 million valuation.
£305 million, yeah.
There you go. So it looks high, but not if you think it's a high-growth company, which, of course, it looks to be a high-growth company. Here you have the Mandarins down in Westminster and the FCA deciding they know best. The market knows nothing. No, you freaking idiots. The market knows best. You're there to just help the market move, not to be an obstacle stopping the market. You know, we went offshore. We did Bank to the Future. We've done Bitcoin Capital. We're raising $1 million. But, you know, that's because the people want crypto. The people want crowdfunding. June 22nd, shareholder event in Hoxton for StartJoin. There's hundreds of shareholders now in StartJoin. You're all welcome to come to the shareholder event in London, in Hoxton, June 22nd. We've got to go.
And bye.
Stay tuned for the second half, a whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time out to turn back to John Aziz of Azizonomics.com. John, welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
It's fantastic to be with you again.
Okay, so in the first half, we talked about Keynesianism. We talked about the shortcomings of this current government. And the question on the table was, can this government, this conservative majority government in the House of Commons, can they change their policies that would make more sense? And by more sense, I mean they would be able to generate some growth without also doubling the national debt.
Well, we're already on a growth path, although the growth has did fall last quarter from 0.6 to 0.3%. So I think the key thing at this point is to not radically change things too much. It's to don't do the austerity they were elected to do.
But they're going to do austerity. Okay, Osborne on July 8th, he's going to introduce £12 billion worth more of austerity cuts.
That's what the manifesto promised.
Okay.
But the other thing
he's going to do that. You're saying don't do that.
I'm saying don't do that.
The
other thing that he mentioned is he was talking about productivity.
Yeah.
And the UK has had flatlining productivity since the first iPhone came out, which is, you know, a crazy thing. The idea that we haven't got more productive in all that time. And Osborne wants to do something about that. And
To get productive, don't you need greater GDP per hour's work, right?
The banker,
isn't that what we can roughly say would be the working definition of productivity? You need more GDP or output per hour's work.
That's right.
Right? So, but in order to get that, you would need money circulating at a lot faster rate than it is now, and it's not because the main banks are hoarding that cash because this government won't address the fact that the four big banks are technically insolvent. They're hoarding all the cash to keep their zombie balance sheets alive. Wouldn't this economy be great if they let those four go bankrupt, nationalize the savings temporarily to protect people's money, and brought in real banks that were competing, like the Bank of Dave by Dave Fishwick, who's got a real bank down there, does real banking? Wouldn't that make sense?
That could have been done in 2008, I think. They could have, you know, nationalized the savings and completely restructured the banking system. They didn't. Would it be beneficial to do it now? Arguably, yes. Arguably, it would destabilize things even more. I don't know. The key thing from my point of view is that we need to stop the austerity, and we need the Bank of England report shows that what we need to get the productivity up is investment. And that can be done in two ways.
You need credit for investment, and the banks aren't lending. So yeah, where's it going to come from?
Well, it can be done through fiscal policy, through government spending on infrastructure and CAPEX, or it can be done through cutting taxes, which is, I think what Osborne may well do.
But adding more government spending is not going to increase productivity because the government is not the greatest entrepreneurial edge in an economy. The government to build stuff is not going to create the next Apple computer or the next Facebook. You know what?
This is the point of Keynesianism. It will give the market the opportunity to do that.
Why not just let the market get on by itself without this interventionalist policies?
Because it's in a slump.
Capitalism is about. You know, in Catholicism, if you sin, you go to hell. In capitalism, if you if you goof up, you go bankrupt. You can't just mollycoddle everybody in the economy and say, oh, you're a nice little Harry Potter character. You won't have to go bankrupt. Here's some money from the Bank of England. I mean, don't you actually have to have some winners and losers on the court? Instead of just making everybody on the street a winner or loser, like, oh, I got my job taken away because they shut the mines down. They put me on benefits. Now they want to scrape my benefits to give a bigger subsidy to some house price speculator and flipper. Right? I mean,
I think the key thing here is, yes, of course, in capitalism you have to have winners and losers, but the economy in the long run as a whole shouldn't be the loser. You shouldn't have this long depressionary slump. You have to give it a chance to get things going again and to get money circulating through it and to get businesses.
You've got four entrenched oligopolist potentates, the four big banks, Barclays, HSBC, Lloyd's, and Royal Bank of Scotland, are gatekeepers. They're sitting there like trolls, not allowing capital to flow. But let's take a...
I agree with you about that. It's a major, serious problem. Maybe banking reform should also be on the table.
But they're the ones who own the regulators. The FCA, the Serious Fraud Office, they're staffed by people inside the banks. A BBC is run by an HSBC board member.
We have to get regulations. Another aspect of this is, aside from tax cuts, which I think would help, and infrastructure investment, which I think would help, would be getting the financial sector flowing so that capital can get to people who could do good stuff with it.
I worked on Wall Street for many years, where it's basically kill or be killed. And there's a famous saying, if wishes were knishes, we'd all be fat. In other words, I hear what you're saying. Like, it would be great if all this stuff were to happen. But wishes don't, at the end of the day, build an economy. You need real entrepreneurs unencumbered by monopolists and oligopolists and shady regulators like the FCA blocking what they need to do to build this economy. That's the main problem. Now, Keynesianism seems to me like all it's doing is it's getting more in the way. Academically and theoretically, it's great. It had its place after World War II. It got blown out by the oil crisis of the 70s. But I don't see what because the people who are in policy-making decisions are not quoting chapter and verse from Keynes's work. They're just cherry-picking stuff to support their views.
The people who are making policy decisions are making a big mess of it. And if they go ahead with this austerity, there's going to be a recession. We could go into Japanese-style debt deflation. And it could be a big mess for the next 5, 10, 20 years. Yeah, I predicted we would last year. And I'm very sad that my predictions starting to come true.
All right, I want to kind of change gears a little bit here because you are really a student of all schools of economics. And so you've come to Keynesianism because you've looked at all the different schools.
I would say that I feel like at this juncture, some Keynesian ideas, in order to generate the growth we need to get back to something much better than this, I would say Keynesianism is the best of a bunch of a bunch of bad shots.
For context, let's just talk about a couple of different ones to give people some thought about it. Now, one school that you hear a lot about is the Austrian school.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So, how would you give the potted version of what is the Austrian school, and what do you like or don't like about it?
The Austrian school is. I think I remember on your show, actually, Sandeep Jaitley gave a very good definition of it, which he said the Austrian school of economics is based on the subjective theory of value. And I wouldn't say that the Keynesianism isn't based on that, but yeah, the Austrian school is based on the subjective theory of value, and it's really the idea that markets happen because people with different subjective needs want to trade with each other and want to enrich each other by participating in the economy together.
Yeah, they warn against things like malinvestment in that school. That what happens is that if people are impeded from trading and they're impeded from exercising their subjective view of value by government intervention, by saying this is worth that and this is worth this, you end up like you have in the UK, which is closer to the Soviet Union than you have in free market economics, where the government, under the auspices of the Bank of England, is giving a price to money. It's no different when Mark Carney says that the price of money is 1% or 1.5%. That's no different than a Soviet Union leader of Politburo saying, we're going to make 1 million cars and they're all going to be priced at 500 rubles a car. There's price fixing. It didn't work. It led to the collapse. And the same thing with Margaret Carney. He's trying to fix the price of money. It's collapsing. You've got deflation, but they won't fire themselves. They're in there. There needs to be a point of perestroika.
Deflation isn't the price of money collapsing. Deflation is the price of money going up.
We're talking about deflation is the collapse of these banks' balance sheets and the collapse of the velocity of money. As a result, the available money that's around, like the price of a Van Gogh or the price of a fine art or a flat in London or a flat in New York, is hitting all-time new highs. Asset prices are going up because mm-hmm. the velocity of money is crashing, and what is around for the and it's being channeled into the pockets of the very few who are then putting that in, not into the economy, but into the dead hand of assets like the $100 million for a Picasso. That doesn't help the economy one bit.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. You kind of have this biflationary phenomenon of the highly priced art prices going up and the housing prices going crazy in the kind of oligarchical sector of the economy, and then
that oligarch section is being fed by the current policies,
right?
The ones who control the elections.
It's true. You're correct about all of this.
And, thank you. And that's been the Kaiser Report. So, no, wait, we have another 2.5 minutes.
But that doesn't mean to say that a little bit of Keynesianism now necessarily means malinvestment. Necessarily means more enrichment for the oligarchs. What I'm saying is, cut taxes for everyone, invest in infrastructure and capital expenditure that is going to benefit the wider society. Maybe build some roads outside of London, build up the country's housing stock. I mean, we have a chronic shortage of housing in this country, a severe chronic shortage caused by in part by bad planning laws that don't let people build enough housing, and in part by the Thatcher government selling off all the council housing stock. That's really what I'm saying. I want some economics for the people. The Tories can do it if they're willing to do it.
Okay, so if you have two choices to describe the current lack of coherent policy in the UK and other G7 countries, you have two choices. A, the first choice is they are not applying the right mix of formula based on what could be, if you were to interpret Keynesian academic theory in a more enlightened way. Or B, the second choice is the reason this is not working is because the government, for some reason, is not applying the rule of law to the four biggest banks in the city of London in this country. Those are your two choices. You have to. Which one do you think is more determinant in figuring out why you have the biggest wealth and income gap in the history of this country, deflation, even though the Bank of England's been pumping money like crazy and they say they want inflation, and you've got riots in the street and Scotland seceding? Of those two doors to go down, one is we need a better academic theory. Two, we need rule of law. Would you pick door number one or door number two? You have 30 seconds.
I think we need both.
Yeah, but you can't have both. That's not the question, John. You have one or the other. Is it one or two?
You know, I, not if we don't have two, number one would help, and if we don't have one, number two would help. You know, I don't know which would necessarily help more. I know you think number two is.
I think you need rule of law. If people finance terrorism, they should go to jail. Like HSBC, they should go to jail.
Obviously, we need big corporations to pay their taxes.
John Aziz, thanks for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you, Max.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, John Aziz of Azizonomics.com. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Next time. Bye, y'all!
The delicious food. TV.
Every day I engage in anti-art, a violent system that is directed at suppressing my imagination to perpetuate the imagination, the myths, of the colonizer.
Hi, this week on the Laura Flanders Show, 1,600 women of color gathered in Chicago recently to talk about the color of violence, the economy of violence, and where change might come from in our violent society. On our program, we talk with Patrice Cullors of Black Lives Matter and Kayi Lumumba Barrow about decolonizing our idea of the solutions and moving beyond the state. You'll find out more coming up. Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, and I'm very excited about our next guest. Patrice Cullors is an organizer and one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter. She's working right now in L.A. on the question of accountability in the sheriff's office. But there's a lot more to Patrice than that. We just played a video recently on this program about Black Lives Matter going to Palestine. And a whole lot of our viewers said, Palestine? I thought this was about Ferguson. Well, Patrice is just back from a 10-day trip to the U.K., and to Ireland, and she's here to tell us about it. Patrice, welcome. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So it's true. We played this fantastic video, and now I understand you were the extraordinary choreographer behind that dance. Black Lives Matter members there in Ramallah, and people said, huh? Explain a little. What's the connection between, first off, the movements?
Well, it was important for the Black Lives Matter movement to show up to Palestine, both in solidarity, but also to learn more about what's happening on the ground to Palestinians. And so it was a Dream Defender delegation, and myself and folks from BYP 100, folks from Dream Defenders, as well as artists actually went on this trip. And there was about 14 of us, mostly all Black folks. And we were really clear that we were going to listen to what was happening to the folks in Palestine, specifically around the occupation. And so much after Ferguson, folks spoke about, or during Ferguson, folks spoke about the sort of the ways in which oftentimes Ferguson felt like Palestine, and the level of occupation and the level of militarization. When I showed up to Palestine, I had already known a lot. I've been studying it for years, but I had nothing would have prepared me for the level of violence and militarization that the Palestinian people are under. And there was also this sort of kindredness that we felt with Palestinians as Black people. The constant sort of battering and terrorizing by military, and for us by police, is eerily similar. Mm. And we thought it was important, even though we knew that it might be a huge risk for a lot of us, to show up and let Palestinians know that we are in deep solidarity with them. And frankly, we believe that Palestine is the new South Africa.
Now, then you went to the UK. Did you find eerie similarities there too?
Yes. Yes. The UK blew my mind. I was never very interested in going to the UK. And so... So I showed up with a huge open heart and open mind to hear from the folks in the United Kingdom, from particularly Black folks in the United Kingdom. And story after story was exactly the same as folks here, Black folks in the United States. Recently, Mark Duggan, he's a huge case that it was very almost similar to Mike Brown, actually. He was coming home, driving his car. He was stopped by police. They eventually surrounded him, and they shot him to death. The police were just let off And that was just a few days ago that that came out. And a lot of folks are saying this is so similar. Yet, what I think I was most disappointed by is how much here in the U.S. we don't know about those stories in the United Kingdom. And so I think for me, the importance of that visit was to talk about international state violence and to talk about the ways in which it impacts both inside this country, but also across the pond.
And as somebody who started her reporting in Northern Ireland, I'd be remiss not to ask you about that part of the trip. We talk about United Kingdom.
Yes.
But it's quite different in terms of policing.
It's Derry City is where I visited, and that it was like a liberated zone. And the ways in which the community of Derry stands in solidarity with Black people in the United States is incredible. We had conversations about a lot of the Northern Irish people talked about Irish people in the States and the level of racism that they've taken on here and this very intense interrogation of what it means to become white in the States. And it was powerful to sort of have this very open dialogue with folks who were naming racism in a particular way. And Northern Ireland, I got to take a tour of all the murals in Northern Ireland. I was there for Bloody Sunday, and so I was able to speak at the marches. And there was such a deep understanding of how occupation impacts our communities.
Bloody Sunday, when British armed forces on the streets of Derry shut down nonviolent protests.
Yes.
Going back to the 60s.
Yep.
So let's talk about the relationship of the issues. You've touched on it, but when you came back, how did it change your sense of what we're really grappling with here?
We have to see this as a global movement. Mm-hmm. We can't see our issues as just domestic issues. We have to see how the U.S. empire exports racism, how it exports militarization. I said this a lot in the U.K. when I spoke to press, which was the United States and all of these different groups of people, they meet together often. They're not isolated, and they're going over tactics together. And so we must do the same. And I think if I didn't make those trips, I wouldn't have understood how necessary it is to call out for a global movement.
And in terms of the nature of that movement, is it a movement about policing? Is it a movement about poverty? Is it a movement about the relationship between the two? How do you see it?
I think that's a really good question. What I see right now, and it's because this is what I've been working on for years, is that we are in a particular moment in history where we are looking at state violence. And I think we can use this moment to look at state violence as a way to look at many other things, such as poverty, such as homelessness. These are not unique to the United States. But something that is unique is the ways in which state violence is being uplifted in this moment in history. And I think we have an opening, which doesn't happen very often, to change policy, to change the culture, and to shift some pretty deadly dynamics.
Are any institutions, whatever their success, that you saw in other countries that you think we could do with here?
You know, I think in the United Kingdom, although there's still a significant amount of state violence, I think their actual process, like their complaint process, is way better than ours. They were pretty disturbed at the level of lack of transparency that happens in this country because all their proceedings are open to the public. And so I think that there is ways in which I learned a lot from their litigators on what can be established here.
Do we still have the 1033 program?
Yes.
Sort of army surplus tanks get put on the streets of U.S. towns?
That's a great question. We still have the program, except it is being monitored now, because it was not being monitored before.
Uh-huh.
So it's, which is...
And who's doing the monitoring?
That's a great question. The DOJ is supposed to be doing the monitoring, which the DOJ, I feel like a lot of us have lost some significant amount of trust in.
And what about this question of accountability in the Sheriff's Department? You've talked about protests. You've talked about meetings. Do you think you're going to get it? Any sense of when this might actually happen?
The Civilian Oversight Body.
Sounds like you have some real...
So we've won. We won in December.
Oh, okay.
So we actually won the body, but right now we're actual negotiations about what the body's going to look like. And that's where it gets tricky, right? Because it's great to win a commission and an oversight body, but if it doesn't have teeth, if it doesn't have power, then we will have to protest that very commission we fought for. So that's where we're at.
So how about you? Where are you at? Do you ever sort of pinch yourself and say, wait a minute, I'm negotiating, talking to the sheriff's office in Los Angeles? Tell us a little bit about your background. I mean, you had experience, your family had brushes with the police department and worse as you were growing up.
Yeah, I pinch myself all the time. I pinch myself all the time. This fight in particular is so important to me because of the level of violence that I witnessed at the hands of the state towards myself and my family. From my earliest memory, which was my home being raided with a battery ram because of the war on drugs and the 1033. And so I remember being 6 years old and the police, you know, rushing in my home and searching throughout my entire house, looking for my uncle at the time. And I'm asking my mother, like, why are they looking in drawers? You know, they just like totally invaded our home. By the time I was 13, I had seen my entire community decimated by law enforcement. We knew the local police department. We knew the local police officer that would harass my siblings. And then by the time I was 16, my brother was incarcerated inside the county jails and was brutally beaten by the sheriff's department. And I think that's actually where my own process starts with being inside this movement. I had a lot of rage. And usually what I do with my rage is, what can I do to fix things? How do I fix this? I didn't start the Dignity and Power Now when I was 16, but I did join the movement when I was 16. And I started at the Labor Community Strategy Center, Bus Riders Union. I was there for 11 years. And then from there, I started Dignity and Power Now. And it's, my brother's been a part of it. My mother's been a part of it. We've sat with the sheriff's department, and it's really actually healing to sort of deal with a department that was in charge of brutalizing your family.
And you're also part of the Dandelion Rising Leadership Institute. What's that?
Yeah, that's one of the programs that Dignity and Power runs. It's a leadership institute for young people ages 16 to 24. We have a partnership with Youthville Charter Schools, and we've developed over 200 youth in Los Angeles.
There's also you as a youth finding yourself homeless, pushed out of your home because you came out.
Yep.
Our movements haven't been good at holding race and gender and queerness and some struggle against some opposing, you know, some enemy with a deadline. all in hands and hearts and heads at the same time. Mm-hmm. How are you doing it differently? How are you managing to be all that you are? And how do you resolve that? The very same people you were fighting for were the people that put you out of your home.
Very good question. I think so much of my life's work is about trying to figure out the whole. And part of joining the movement was my way of figuring out my whole. Yeah. You know, where do I fit in this? And the movement was my chosen family. You know, I remember showing up to my organization and being queer and out and woman and really weird and folks completely embracing me and also seeing that as important leadership skills and seeing a deep leader in me. And so I think what we're trying to do both in Black Lives Matter and also in Dignity and Power Now is see the leaders for who they are and develop them.
And where does your art come into this? I have a suspicion this is where the art comes in.
It's everywhere. Literally everywhere. I just actually finished a production called Power from the Mouths of the Occupied that brings stories of Black folks who've been impacted by state violence to stage. We had a production in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is where I started, where I did an artist fellowship with the Arca Center for Social Justice and Leadership. And then in Los Angeles, I brought it to Los Angeles and trained all non-actors to tell their stories. And it's the narrative to me is the most powerful. I mean, we can sort of give statistics all day, but someone tells their story. You can't deny someone's story. And so that's where my work comes in.
And my final question, we're talking at Insight, Color of Violence Conference, taking place in Chicago this year. Angela Davis was one of the keynoters, and she talked about the economy of violence. I'm still unpacking in my mind what that means.
Exactly.
What did it mean to you?
I think how it landed on me was really talking about the ways in which violence is commodified. The ways in which violence is packaged and the ways in which violence is really given and produced to and families and churches and structures, and then reproduced. Me being pushed out of my home was a form of violence, and that was produced from my family's religion that then kicked me out in the streets, right? And so I think the economy of violence is actually a really important terminology for us to unpack as a movement, because we can also cycle through it inside of our own spaces and places that are supposed to be healing and transformative.
So we need a new economy, and we need a new economy of nonviolence.
Yes.
It's great to have you, Patrice. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for your work.
What happens when a revolutionary begins a new career as an artist? Kayi Lumumba Barrow was a founder and national organizer of the prison abolition group Critical Resistance. And she's worked with Republic of New Africa, Queers for Economic Justice, Southerners on New Ground, the Student Liberation Action Movement, and many more. Well, she's now in a new phase of her life as an artist. She's launched an art and organizing project called Gallery of the Streets, and she's working on a visual opera, as she calls it, for the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. We had a chance to catch up with her and spend some time with her work recently in Chicago.
So part of this project emerged out of me as an organizer and a revolutionary, working primarily around stopping the prison industrial complex and moving out of that, using art to kind of free my mind, because there's not a lot of victories in the PIC, right? Because the system is set up to maintain its carceral system control. So I don't get to see a lot of abolition happening in my line of work, right? So I needed ways to move through that and keep resisting and trying new things. Because the idea of abolition is a what? New thing, according to the normatives of this society, right? So every day I engage in anti-art, a violent system that is directed at suppressing my imagination to perpetuate the imagination, the myths of the colonizer, who will benefit from me thinking about myself and the world from his perspective, right? Am I the only one? No? Okay, good. Okay, so to try to subvert that through the art, I'm trying to see what we can do outside of the normatives, again, to address the question of absurdity, first starting with the absurdity. Police killing children is absurd. That's just absurd. That's not normal. That's not a normative, right? The fact that right now black women are the number one population being evicted, and what comes with dislocation? Dispossession. So the questions that I'm raising or attempting to raise, what I'm interested in, is how do we subvert the absurd, right? Why are we addressing the absurd, which is how we are living, particularly those of us who are black and are rooted, our whole experience is rooted in anti-black violence. Why are we responding to that as if that is logical and sane? Why aren't we responding to that in the same way that we respond to absurd events and flip the script? And so the opera is an attempt to, you know, how do we, like, pull on our imaginations to redirect our everyday experiences? The full piece is called Echo Hybridity Love Song for Nola. And I've identified this concept or created a concept called a visual opera. The opera is composed of music, choreography, visuals, film, sculpture, and guerrilla theater. When I went to New Orleans, right after Katrina, I made a commitment to that earth that I was not going to let this space not be marked and recognized, because it was harmful. This is a triptych. This piece is largely contributions from
15, specifically 15 black feminists in NOLA in New Orleans who are going to be working on the opera. We began a couple weeks ago building an altar. The first piece is comprised of objects, nature, found objects and donated objects, and family heirlooms that represents black women's resistance. And if you look, you have to look at my work kind of intricately because there's always something. I try to play with ideas a lot and use symbols to do that. So, for example, she has Walmart panties that have cotton. So what are we saying here about black women's labor? You will see in her intricacies different, like I said, signs, symbols, and offerings that represent our history, particularly black women's history in terms of New Orleans specifically. I think of them mostly as domestic workers. So you see a lot of symbols around domestic labor. There's a plot, and the story is that there was once a group of free birds who were in search of home, and they could not find home was not recognizable to them, and so they are in search of home or to recreate the idea of home. The final opera will be a roving performance and installations in various locations throughout New Orleans. The group of black feminists I'll be working with are focusing on the movements. These are abstractions of some of the movements. This piece is movement one, Welcome to the Subversive Ball. This is movement two, and this is called Is This Intentional Subterfuge? And this is the last one that intrigues me. I mean, they all do, but this one kind of really gets me. I don't know what it means. Bodies Without Organs, which is a title from Deleuze. Each of these movements will start to take shape through installations. I'm doing the prelude, which is Aria of the Hybrid Revolutionary. Madame Sankofa sings the blues. And I'm doing the coda, the after, and that is called WWFD, What Would Fanon Do? And so I'm trying to really think about this idea of transformation from a post-colonial idea, location, and using art as a mechanism to help us think from a decolonial, again, location.
You can find out more about Kayi Lumumba Barrow's project at our website. From Belfast to Baltimore to Baghdad, bad police tactics have a habit of spanning the globe. Holding police to account is a global job too, and yet it's one we tend to leave in the hands of victims' families. Shortly after the death of Baltimore's Freddie Gray, a leaked police document claimed that a prisoner transported with Gray heard him banging against the walls of the vehicle as if he was, quote, intentionally trying to injure himself. That prisoner quickly refuted that story, but not before it brought to my mind very similar claims made by police in Northern Ireland. Throwing oneself downstairs, punching own face and poking own eyes, injury to the neck by attempted self-strangulation. That's how investigators explained injuries sustained in police custody in Ireland under British rule. Human rights investigators and community activists have spent years since digging up documents that get beneath that spin. Now they can show that while they fed the public guff about self-inflicted harm, internally, British ministers were sanctioning torture. That new evidence is returning attention to a case that has implications in the UK and the US too. It involves 12 men aged between 19 and 42 who were rounded up by the British Army as part of their internment without trial program and subject to hooding, prolonged stress, white noise, sleep deprivation, and deprivation of food and drink, known collectively as the five techniques developed by the British during the so-called Troubles. The last time the European Commission of Human Rights ruled on this particular case, they declared the treatment inhuman and degrading, but not torture.
That 1978 ruling was reportedly used by George W. Bush's administration as justification for its infamous torture memos, and the five tactics started showing up from Abu Ghraib to Gitmo shortly thereafter. Now, the Irish government is backing a call for the court to reopen the case. The families will be represented by, among others, attorney Amal Clooney. But that shouldn't obscure decades of work done by grassroots groups, like the Center for the Administration of Justice and the Pat Finucane Center. Their victory really will be ours to celebrate, too. Because an injury to one really is an injury to all. In policing, it's truer than you might imagine. Tell me what you think. Write to me, Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at grittv.org. And thanks.
Oh my, everybody, there is so much happening. The world is setting itself free. I've been practicing cleaning on the inside, listening to all these pieces of the puzzle. I was, come on, voice. I was just reading a very simple line at the beginning of Key of Enoch 2:15 before I go ahead and read. And Commander Dougie, you can, you know, round up our sister Rainbird. We're coming to this reading time, if you don't mind, Captain Doug. And the key, again, is the key to the sciences of the past are given in the desert. Wherever Melchizedek has reigned, there will be found the round numbers of how the kilocosm is extended to the cosm of time arcs. The keys to sciences of the past are given in the mountains. Wherever Melchizedek has reigned, there will be found the fire letters of how the cosm of time arcs are extended to the kilocosm. And I was just looking at this key. You know, we're in 2015, and this is key 215. And then this, the first piece says that the key number 15 tells the children of light to look at the ancient megalithic sites at Teotihuacan, Palenque, Tiahuanaco, the Tarim Basin, Stonehenge, the Great Pyramid, and the Sea of Galilee, to see the round numbers, the calculations of star mathematics, which are part of the greater astrophysical geometry. So next Thursday, we'll continue this thought with our dear brother Nassim Haramein. Just, I thought, something to contemplate. That's key number 215. Okay, we're on another chapter here with our brother. Let's see. Commander Dougie, can you fetch our sister Rainbird for us? Calling Captain Doug. Are you there? Okay, yes. We could use... There we go. I don't think she has a computer, so you'll have to call her on the phone, I think, Doug. Her computer fell down and went boom. And we need to manifest a new computer for our sister. That would be good. Yes. Okay, so this is chapter 9. Workday.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so Rainbird, I see. I think, Doug, you'll have to call her on the telephone. Her computer crashed. Yeah, it did. Okay, so I made up my way up the mountain, up the main highway, and turned off at the footage road that soon became a dirt road on the way to the mountain clinic. I couldn't help but think of the dreams I had with the owl and how in the dream it resembled the the one in real life. As you remember in the last chapter, he had an encounter with an owl. And I don't think he was able to avoid it, but it came right in his face and while he was driving in the car. Wish fulfillment or anxiety is probably it. At least that's what Freud would make all of this. After all, he invented all this dream stuff. Yeah, I better call her on the phone. So he should know. Oh, okay. Okay. Very good. Excuse me. I have to. At least that's what Freud would make of all this. After all, he invented this dream stuff, so he should know. However, what about Miss Chavez? And the dream I had of her. I wondered. I guess I'll just keep my objectivity and my boundaries. I really don't know how to do this stuff, this dream stuff, and especially not in this setting with these folks. They live in a dream world, yet the world around them seems to be falling apart in despair. With all the social problems that have been going on for so many generations. Driving up this road, I had become pretty routine, and I had never really noticed the beauty of the rock formations before. There were deep orange and red colors that had many contours, and the shadows were black in the areas where the early morning sun still hadn't shed its light. The shadows seemed to be hiding some special events or possibilities that needed the darkness in order not to be disturbed. As the sun made its way across the sky, it illuminated these shadows and created others as the rock formations continued the interplay of light and shadow. This process seemed to have a life of its own, and I was surprised that I had never seen this over the years. Maybe this is what it means, as they say, that everything is alive, I thought. All of the constant changing was something I had never realized, and in my mind, things were solid and constant across time. My journey up the mountain continued with more of the same thoughts and realizations. I had some apprehension about the day's clinical activities, and especially what to say to Miss Chavez. My thoughts also turned to planning another visit to see Terrence and Burley. Life as I had known it was changing, indeed. For the new, for me, new ideas, new energy, seemed to be emerging from unknown places in my psyche. This must be how it works with the rock formations and the illumination of shadows, I thought. I wonder, though, as the rocks know they are being illuminated, who knows? Why is this important? Yeah, our rock brothers and sisters, rock people. I arrived at the clinic. The building was old and made of adobe manufactured by some New Age company that prided itself in benefiting the environment. My office was a small space at the end of the hall, opposite the rooms where the physician and the nurse practitioner saw patients for their medical concerns. All of the professional providers were Caucasian, while Native people who came from this area or other parts of the country held the lower paraprofessional positions. As a consultant, I was able to come and go more freely. In addition, it kept me from having to get involved in community politics. And what's that word? And feuds, some of which spanned at least three generations. I was the first psychologist to work in this community. This allowed for the community to and me to invent my role and allowed for more creativity than some of the others working there had. After all, how much leeway could a medical practitioner have in diagnosing a physical problem? Matters of the mind were another thing altogether, especially as the Aboriginal healing factor was included in the equation. In actuality, the Aboriginal healing factor affected the physical aspects of the person, except that not all of the practitioners were open to any ideas, except those generated from the Western medical model. During that day, I saw several people who were suffering from addictive disorder. There appeared to be many of these disorders in this community. The patients discussed the difficulty they were having in becoming free of addiction. I listened and offered some behavioral interventions and referrals to the local 12-step programs, which appeared not to be having much of an effect on the patients. I knew these programs were not effective because most of the people I referred there had already been to them and still could not deal with their severe addictions. Many were in the second and third generation of addiction and saw little hope in view of so many deaths in the community, which were directly tied to addiction disorder. That afternoon, I had an appointment with Ms. Chavez. I was still a bit nervous about the dream and still ambivalent about how much I should disclose as anything. My guess was that she would have other things to talk about, and all this dream stuff would just evaporate. Otherwise, the focus should remain on her and leave me out of it. Miss Chavez was early, and she appeared to be in a pleasant mood as I went to greet her. Turn the page. Good morning. Good afternoon, Miss Chavez. I hope your week is going well. Oh, yes, thank you, and I hope things are well with you. I've been thinking about today, and I'm glad we get to talk some. Have a seat and make yourself comfortable, Miss Chavez. Again, thank you for your kindness to an old woman. I was wondering how to start the session. I could see she was holding her dream journal, and I could feel a little trepidation as the thought of going in that direction. I really didn't want to go there. Miss Chavez had no such apprehension, and she had a mind of her own. She started the session by saying, "I did have some dreams last week. Of course, I always do. There is one that bothers me a bit, though, and I would like to know what you think of it. Of course, I'm sure I mentioned to you that I'm not an interpreter of dreams, and my knowledge isn't very deep in this area. I'm sure we can find some meaning in it for you, though. Well, the dream that I want to talk about the dream took place in this office with you and me sitting just like this. There was a fire in the middle of the room here, and I was putting my baskets into the fire. I couldn't help myself. I know that I would never do that, since those baskets are sacred, and there are many stories in each one of them. So that's the dream." She sat back and gave me a look that simply seemed to imply, "Well, what do you think of that?" I really tried to hold on to my sense of blank screen professionalism. She had had that exact same dream I had a couple of nights ago. As soon as she said she was putting baskets into the fire, I remember distinctly that the objects being put into the fire in my dream were also baskets. Now what? I thought. I bet they were the exact same baskets, too. Man, I'm in over my head. What to do now? I've got to say something, and whatever I say is going to determine the therapeutic alliance and could determine as her neuroses gets better or worse. Oh, what would Freud say? Of course. He'd put it back in on her and ask what she thinks this means. Yeah, yeah, this is about transference. Jung? I don't know what the hell he would say. Probably some crazy stuff. Oh, shit, Burley? There's no one to ask. My mind went through these thoughts into the space of 2 seconds. In order to get more time to think about this, I replied, "That's an interesting dream, Miss Chavez. Do you have any associations?" After saying that, I felt really stupid. How condescending that must have felt to this old woman who was being sincere in her quest for understanding and healing. Not really. As I had all that, then I guess I wouldn't have to come to you with the dream in the first place, huh? I really need you to tell me what this means, especially since I have had the dream several times, except that this time you were in it, of course. My thoughts raced again over some of the things I had read on dreams. Recurring dreams are important. The fact that I had the same dream as hers must also mean something. Let's see. Somewhere in his crazy writings, Jung talks about psychological contagion. That is the psyche of two people having a relationship that is a sort of counter-transference kind of thing. Bet Burley would know what to say. Terrence would too. Shit, where are these people when you need them? I want to say something right now. I can't wait for a consult. Let's see. Cognitive behavioral stuff. No, that won't even touch this. And it would just insult her even further. I need a theory now. These were the loose associations that took place in about 5 seconds. I was getting visibly anxious. I could feel sweat forming on my forehead, and I knew she could see this. Before any more thinking could go on, I blurted out, "I had the same dream." I immediately felt both relief and overwhelming damning feeling, as though I had betrayed all of my training and all of the teachings of all of the fathers of Western psychology. "I can't believe I said that," I thought. However, it's the truth, and I couldn't help it, as I had the dream. I'm just being honest about the counter-transference stuff. Carl will literally freak out, that is, as I tell him. He might even take me before an ethics committee and get me into supervision. "Oh, it'll be okay. You haven't done anything wrong here," I told myself. Miss Chavez gave a smile and replied, "So you did dream about me. I knew that you could do this. My dreams have always told me the truth, and when they told me to see you, I knew that you were also a dreamer." Her obvious relief was confusing me. She acted as though I had done a wonderful intervention, and I felt I had really done the opposite. Why should she be so happy just because I dreamed about her and had a similar dream? These were questions that would require both intensive study and conversations with people who knew about this dream time business. And what is this stuff about me being a dreamer? Everyone is a dreamer. Studies definitely support that, my mind rambled. "Well, I guess we're all dreamers," I said. "Not really. I agree that everyone has dreams. Even animals have dreams, yet not everyone is a dreamer." "I guess I don't see the difference," I replied weakly. I didn't want to have her start helping me, since she was the one who came for help, or at least that appeared to be her initial reason for coming. The main difference is, that dreamers are those who can move into the dream time and keep an awareness that they have been there, and then get understanding. This can happen only after many lifetimes of practice. Eventually, everyone will become a dreamer. Again, my mind wandered. Here's this dream time business again, and these Buddhist ideas. Oh, what's with this lifetimes of practice? I thought that was all Asian stuff. So, you also believe in reincarnation, huh? I asked. What's to believe? That's just the way things are, she replied with simple assuredness. It's interesting to see that familiar beliefs are held by people in different parts of the world. A man named Carl Jung called that the collective unconscious and explained it by saying that somehow we were all interconnected. I lectured as though I knew what I was saying. Collective unconsciousness is just unconscious is just another way of saying the dream time, she said. I have heard of this young person. He actually came and visited some of the pueblos up north during the 30s. I've heard that he is also a dreamer. He was a dreamer. He died some years ago. He is still. You see, once you become a dreamer, you always be a dreamer. And you always be alive in the dream time. I guess not everybody knows this, she said gently. I appreciate your kindness in telling me these things. I guess I don't know much about this dream time business. You know all there is to know. You just don't know what you know, she replied, and she got up to leave. We still have some time left, I said. I know. Yet we did what we needed to today. We'll talk about the dream itself next time, she said in a manner that let me know she knew I needed some time to reflect and study. Well, thank you, Miss Chavez, and I hope to see you soon. Maybe see you in the dream time again, huh? She said with a sheepish smile. Maybe, I replied, and she was gone. After Miss Chavez left, I sat in my office for a while. I wondered, as there might have been an ethical infraction in my telling her my dream. I know it's all right to disclose to clients, yet this might be a bit much. After some pondering, I decided I was being a bit too particular about this and that there was no ethical infraction. However, there might be a blurring of the therapeutic boundaries. How could it be otherwise? After all, I had shared some very private information with this patient. Perhaps this is a way that hasn't been studied in Western psychology, I thought. This might be something that needs to be explored further through research. Indeed. Once I had settled in my mind that things were going to work out with Miss Chavez, I went out to the waiting area. It was about 2:00 in the afternoon, and Amy was there, waiting to speak with me. Amy always seemed so serious. She rarely laughed or smiled, even as everyone else was laughing at some funny story or joke. Because of her serious nature, it was difficult to know, as there was a pressing matter, or as she just wanted to catch up with something on some patient scheduling. Good afternoon, Amy, I said. Well, hello. I noticed that you have some time late this afternoon, and Terrence wants to see you. About anything in particular? The moment I said it, I realized the question didn't make any sense. There couldn't be anything specific with this man. His whole life consisted of what appeared to be inaccurate generalizations tied together by an even more general construct. That is, this thing he called the dream time. I knew that as I went It would go into the evening, and I really wasn't planning to stay late. Yet then I realized that a visit with Terrence might shed some light on this dreaming I'll be doing. Okay, I guess I can go see him. I just have to see a couple more people and tidy up some charting, and then we can go up there. I guess we're coming too? You're coming too? Oh, no. I just came to let you know he wants to see you. I just came back from his place. Oh. Is everything all right? Is Terrence okay? Is he doing okay? I asked. He's always all right. Even when the doctors say that he's very sick, he doesn't believe that he is. He says it's just the body that isn't feeling good. And something about watching the sickness. You know how that he talks. It is hard sometimes to know what he's really saying. Oh, that's a relief. I mean, I thought I was the only one who didn't understand him. I guess I was thinking that he spoke in some special dialect that only people from here were privy to. Oh, no. Everybody knows that Terrence is a special person and has special knowledge. Some understand him better than others do, like the woman you just saw. She understands him, overstands him, and he seems to overstand her. I felt there was some kind of conspiracy between Terrence and Miss Chavez. So these two talk to each other and actually overstand each other, eh? I said to myself, what's to keep them from making me the fool in some kind of prank? Easy now. You don't want to start slipping into some paranoid place. Yes, they both. They both seem to talk about similar things. I guess this dream stuff is or was pretty important around here, huh? Some of the old people tell stories of how the dream was and still is the medicine. Not too many left who know about these things. And the ones who are left don't like to talk about it. Guess they're kind of afraid of it. Afraid? Afraid? Why would anyone be afraid of such a natural thing? After all, everyone dreams, I replied feebly. I really don't know too much time. I really don't have too much time, and your next patient is here. However, some time ago, the shamans in this area and other areas were involved in a dream war. A lot of people were hurt, and some of the families still suffer from the pain that was inflicted by these evil dreamers. Guess you might call it witchcraft or bad medicine. Well, gotta go. With that, she left. I stood there for a few seconds trying to analyze what she had just said. My mind also went to the images I had seen with Terrence a few weeks ago and how the image showed the killing of a shaman. That is a pretty rough sanction for ethical violations. And talk about negative transference. What's going on with that? Why would anyone hurt their community as there's already a lot of pain? And who are these evil dreamers? Man, there's a lot to learn. I thought as I turned my attention to the next patient, a man suffering from chronic alcoholism, as were so many of my patients here, I must admit I was less than present in my next two sessions, and I felt a little guilty about this. My mind kept drifting toward Terrence, Mr. Chavez, and evil dreamers. I thought I would ask Terrence about this as I saw him later. I felt that perhaps I should be more proactive, ask specific questions, and get some specific answers. I actually started looking forward to seeing him. I was really feeling left alone by my profession and also very insecure about what I was getting myself into, even though intuitively this felt right. Okay, and Lady Master Rain Bird, I pass this Dream Times talking stick in the dream world of number 15 of Teotihuacan and Palenque and oh, the pyramids and great pyramids in the Tarim Basin and Tiwa. What's that other one? I'm learning. Tihuanaco. There you go. So we're wandering in the emerald serpent feather turf of Quetzalcoatl for sure this year of 2015. And I pass this talking stick to you with a little added fairy dust from the land from which we all come called Titalacoria. Here it comes, Rainbird.
I caught it.
Good. There it's. You're welcome. Sound pretty good. Sound a little better.
Good.
There we go. Yes.
Yeah.
Lots of bird energy this night, I must say. We landed in the owl medicine again here.
We have had lots of good bird medicine tonight. That's good. It's been a lovely, delightful evening. Thank you so much. So much going on. Yes, very relaxing. So, enjoy the story. In the dream time, that's very fun. So, we like that. We had that good bear medicine. Talk about that dream time tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, let's go to that dream time. I'm ready. So thank you all for joining us this evening. Thank you for your lives. Thank you for all the ways you show up in your lives. Let's just dream in this new, let's dream in this new Sarah, this new way, new day, this new beginning. So much gratitude for all the love. Well, 13, thank you. Tiny the heart. In the cash. I even know me myself. I pass the soccer stick right back to you, Mama. Whatever you have planned, I know it'll be good. Thank you.
Thank you, Rainbird. Thank you, Rainbird. And, you know, we did a lot of weaving of the web of life today, where the more traditional music and the more traditional values and some, you might say, path makers into a new way of seeing a path to peace, and that it really isn't so necessary to injure and lose people in conflict. And that key, conflict resolution. Rumi here is about, you are the comfort of my soul. Let's see how this works. I guess it's time to sail away. We'll see you on another type of ship. We'll see you on the bridge and in your dreams. And tomorrow, let's join together again with Cheryl on Monday, too. It's at 9:15 Eastern time, 6:15. And Rama, help me. This is 605-475-5950. Thank you. Again, 605-475-5950. And the PIN code is 946-7445. 1 pound, and then we can continue our journey. And I believe this Tuesday we'll be at Ashtar on the Road too. Just check ashtarontheroad.com out, and that's at 9 o'clock on the Eastern time zone and 7 o'clock here at Mountain, 6 o'clock Pacific. Much aloha, and you call on those Menahunis. They show up in your dreams at the end of the rainbow with the pot of gold. And leave your heart open to what all that's all about. So on this good red road again, we shall travel. We're getting to know Quetzalcoatl quite well, that emerald serpent-feathered one. I might have to pick up that book and read a little more about Quetzalcoatl, yes. And so until we see each other again, it's a good time to feel the joy now and the change and be that change that we know we came here to be. And we learned a little bit about that Ho'oponopono. Let's keep our cleaning, house cleaning, and be grateful. Every time we meet, we got some more work to do. And that's the joy. It's the work of love. So namaste, inshallah. We are all another ourselves, and Sat Nam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Ahomi Takuyasin. Just all seven generations on to now. Namaste.